Welcome back. This is episode 94 of Ladies with Gumptions, titled Confessions. I am entering today. My name is Jessica, and I'm here with
May
and Tatiana.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DC TV in a flash, and some people also say that we watch the shit they don't want to watch. It's because that's how we roll.
They say it because it's the truth.
It is the truth. You can contact us if you want to talk to us. You can contact us on Twitter at DC. At DCTV Gumption, email ladieswgumption at gmail.com, Tumblr ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, which has gotten like very, very active recently. So we're trying to keep up, but it's getting like, you know, I don't know how many asks we've gotten there, but we're trying, people. So thank you for loving us. You can listen to our episodes on iTunes, which I heard that we were having a bit of an issue with the Apple Podcasts. May, is that right?
Yes, and I'm looking into that this weekend. I guess there's a glitch that it's not uploading immediately, but she said she could see it like after 2 days. So I don't know what's going on, but I'll check.
That sucks. Anyway, while iTunes gets their shit together, you can also find us on Google Play, Spotify, and on Stitcher. I don't know if we're still uploading to Facebook or not, but hopefully we get our shit together.
Spoiler alert, we are not.
Patreon, if you are a subscriber to Patreon, thank you so much for your patronage. And as a thank you, we give you the episodes 24 hours in advance before they go live to the rest of the different Podomatic and all those places. So if you like to get your news first or your shade or whatever you want, whatever you get out of this podcast first, please support our Patreon page because it just helps us keep the podcast up and running. Watchmen HBO just came out, so we're thinking about doing like a special episode for that, which would be exclusive to Patreon. And then also, if May has finished Elite seasons 1 and 2, have you finished season 2?
I'm halfway through season 2.
Okay. So when May finishes Elite Season 2, we're also thinking about doing something for that. So just if you have any other kind of ideas and things for Patreon exclusives that you want to share or want us to cover, let us know. In the news section, I think we've all seen the Joker movie by now, right?
No. But in my heart, I've seen it.
In her heart, she's seen it. I remember Shane gave us his feedback on it, and then I saw it like a week ago. I was in Thailand, and so I saw it while I was in Thailand because that's just what you do when you're on vacation. And I think May saw it. So for me, like, it's a really well put together movie. And I think, like, I remember when we were first talking about the critics and all of the, you know, not hype, but just people like, oh my gosh, this is going to inspire so many mass shooters and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of like whipped up the public into a frenzy over what this movie was supposed to be, or in their minds, I guess. And so I was kind of not, well, I guess, surprised, because it wasn't like that at all. I don't think it really justified anything that he did in the movie, but it kind of added like a lot of layers to Joker as a character. And I thought Joaquin Phoenix did a really good job, you know, portraying this guy and like his condition being based on like the laughing condition, which we talked about before with, you know, why it's so well received for him, but not for Lupita Nyong'o when she did kind of a similar thing that really added some layers to her character in her movie. But just based on like this movie, I actually really kind of enjoyed it. And I thought that all of the panic beforehand, or like when the movie was just coming out, was kind of unwarranted, especially seeing the responses and how the Joker is being used afterwards. You know, the most, I guess, dangerous thing people are doing is using the Joker in part of like their protests in different countries and things like that. So
right,
yeah. And it's in the movie, it's not him. He's not like he's the inspiration behind the protests that go on in the movie, but he's not the one like leading it or justifying his violence and starting this movement because of whatever happened to him. So it's just kind of like a unintended consequence of him doing like his own thing, like his own storyline, but it has these effects that play out, ripple out into the city kind of thing. So I thought it was a really good movie. May, what did you think?
I think it was beautifully shot. First and foremost, every scene just felt like great to absorb visually, you know, the color scheme and whatnot. And I was also just deeply uncomfortable watching it, which I guess was the point.
Yeah.
Like every time Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker creeped me the fuck out. Like I don't know if I had a nightmare or not after that, but it was just very uncomfortable watching him in a lot of instances. Yeah. Specifically the scene where he's, I think one of his best scenes is when he's coming down the stairs.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure was like been made into a bunch of GIFs, but it was just like so well done.
Because you see
kind of, yeah. Like how he's just kind of going into this, absorbing what he's been doing and how people are taking it. And evolving into who he becomes eventually. I think, though, my biggest issue with it probably is the fact that at the end of the day, it didn't stick with any kind of message. Like, it kind of flip-flopped between what it was trying to say. You know what I mean? Like, right. It sort of was like, yes, he wasn't killing for any good reason. He didn't have, it wasn't because he was who he was and that's why he was doing what he was doing, but you could see too that he really enjoyed the attention that it gave him because he felt like he's been overlooked his entire life. Like, right. I think what bugged me is that the opening scene was a bunch of kids beating up on him, and it just felt like throughout the rest of the movie he was supposed to be seen as this really pathetic character. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the movie leaned into wanting to say something of a certain nature and then kind of backtracking and not saying anything at all just left it a little bit muddled for me. Like, if you're just going to make a point, just make it, you know, don't be too scared to do that if that's what you want to say, you know?
Right. And I think that the thing for me that I thought was the most weakest is how the whole uprising and protesting of Gotham and how that kind of came about, because it was like it's vaguely mentioned that there is this divide between like the working class and the super rich, and the whole thing kicks off with an incident that on the train with between Arthur, mm-hmm. like yeah, Arthur and these three like Wall Street guys, and that somehow sparks off the whole powder keg in Gotham. But it was kind of like, I think that was probably the weakest part, to that they really didn't go into why Gotham was so, the tension was so high in Gotham. And then also the whole the Thomas Wayne slander made him like conservative like jackass Republican kind of dude, and you know, the whole kind of relationship between Arthur Fleck and Thomas Wayne and Bruce Wayne and all that kind of stuff was just, you know, that's also, I think, one of the things they kind of went somewhere and then backtracked on, because they went somewhere like there was a connection and they backtracked it off later. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, was that really necessary? Did we need that? Was it necessary? Did you just want to show Bruce in the movie? Like, I don't understand that part, but
yeah, because they go through the whole trouble of again showing us the death scene, because it has been played 50 million times to everybody and their mother. So I don't think that was necessary, because, you know, it was just kind of, once again, it sort of turned into a Bruce Wayne origin story, but not really, you know?
Right. Like,
so that part wasn't necessary.
Yeah. And even if you still wanted to have like the parents' death in there, you didn't really need like that, you know, Arthur's fixation on Thomas Wayne to pull that off, because mm-hmm. it's like in the middle of these protests anyway, and the Waynes do represent the super rich, so I feel like you didn't really need that kind of drama in the movie. But yeah, I thought the ending was really great, actually, like the whole like his debut. The only thing that I guess the only thing that I thought was really weird And I don't understand. It's not just Joaquin Phoenix, but it's like men in general when they're trying to be like Oscar worthy and they do this whole weird, and they're playing like the whole underdog or whatever, the loner, and they do this whole weird like body contortionist thing, like, you know, if the actor is like starving himself for the role or like contorting himself, like Arthur Fleck has like this whole like hunched sharp shoulder angle thing that I just think is weird and kind of like, I don't know, doing it for the Oscar.
yeah, I feel the same way, especially when it comes to the award season where it's like they're gonna spend the whole couple of months talking about how much weight he lost. And somebody made a good point. I can't remember who it was, but we live in 2019. We have so much CGI and special effects that you could have made him look a certain way, like they did with Chris Evans in the first Captain America movie.
Yeah.
And then gotten away with it without having him actually be unhealthy in real life. You know what I mean?
But men are rewarded for that. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anywho's, moving on. Jeffrey Wright has been officially confirmed as Chief Gordon for Matt Reeves' the Batman movie. So whoop whoop. Also Barbara
Gordon. Had to stand.
Yes. And then in DC TV news, we had the first photo of Intrepid reporters Iris West and Lois Lane together. Candace, I think Bitsy originally posted the photo and Candace reposted, or someone posted a photo.
I think Bitsy posted it first. Yeah.
Yeah.
She got tired of waiting.
Yeah, she wasn't about to wait for Candace.
So in case you were still wondering, Iris and Lois are definitely meeting and doing stuff in the crossover. And I think earlier in this week, Candace also like posted an Instagram story of her, Bitsy, and Tyler headed to set. So Super West, here we come. Also, and this is going to be great news for a lot of Arrow fans, Emily Beck is back for Arrow's final episode. So I guess it's confirmed. Like, I didn't think she was going to be in the crossover anyway, but she's not in the crossover, but she will be back in Arrow's final episode. So the thing, I guess, it's Instagram watch for Emily to see whether this final scene is a new scene or it's a scene that she recorded way back in the 7th season finale.
Also, it's the finale, not the crossover, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That's interesting to me because that makes me think that it's not, as I was expecting, a reunion and whatever. Or I guess maybe the crisis just doesn't end that way for Oliver because obviously there's two more episodes. So is it like she comes to his funeral? Or is it like we don't see what happened to Oliver until the coda of the finale?
Also, we have news that Superman and Lois spinoff show was announced as being in development by the CW, and this Superman Lois show is Tyler Hoechlin and Bitsy Tulick, and Todd Helbing is writing the pilot and executive producing.
Yeah, you lost me at Todd.
So I was gonna say, how do we feel about this?
I mean, at least there will be no ship wars on this show because they already are together, they have a kid, whatever, they're Lois and Clark, and
I don't think anyone would dare try and get between Lois and Clark or try.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about Todd show running it, but all I can say is that at least it'll be from the start. So it'll be his vision from the get go and not like he's not taking over from anybody else per se.
Right. I mean, Black
Girl. So we'll have to see like how he has with a clean slate.
Yeah. As far as I know, Spartacus was good, but I didn't watch Spartacus.
I did. So, I watched like a season.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah. How many seasons of Spartacus were there? Two?
I think
two
or three. Three? Two or three.
I think I watched like the first two, but I like Spartacus.
Okay. So it's not like he doesn't have any idea how to run a show. I think it was more that the Flash was kind of foisted on him was maybe the issue, and he did not have the creative juices for it. So yeah, hopefully, Superman and Lois will, you know, be okay.
I just feel like it's a little, for me, I Todd aside, it feels a little crowded to have Supergirl and then Superman and Lois, and the fact that Superman is, you know, another white dude in the CW, like the Arrowverse. So it's, I guess he's, you know, you think that Batwoman was taken over for Arrow, but I guess now you're adding in Superman and Lois and I don't
the
yeah
canaries. Green Arrow
and the canaries. And the canaries. So it just feels very crowded over at the CW.
Yeah, I mean they're both in
we're
development.
Definitely
obviously, they're not
to at
gonna
at least one more show.
Yeah, I think Legends is out.
Yeah. So, anywho, we'll keep tabs on that and see how that develops. But moving into feedback, we got quite a bit of feedback. We had, we also had some feedback from our podcast last week from Adora721. So I guess I'll start there once I find it. And Adora is just saying, love your feedback as always. Just to be clear on Killer Frost as a killer, Killer Frost killed Black Flash, who was working for the Speed Force to capture evil speedsters. Two, Killer Frost is an accessory to H.R. Wells' murder, which is the crime. Additionally, Killer Frost has attempted to murder Barry, Cisco, Tracy Brand, and threatened to murder Cecile. These are all crimes, even if not successful, and those crimes are acts of someone who has in mind a killer mindset. Killer Frost is also accessory to human trafficking, some of which led to the deaths of a few of the bus metas, not to mention Killer Frost tortured people who Eminent wanted her to hurt. If Killer Frost fans are comforting themselves with the belief that Killer Frost hasn't really killed someone, they'd be mistaken. She is a killer, has a killer mindset, and has shown zero remorse for end of her crimes, end of TED Talk. Which, I mean, and even
damn, like, Adora, you went all in.
Yeah. But a lot of it's like attempted murder or threatened
attempted
to kill.
Attempted
Killer Frost.
This is not a defense of Killer Frost, but the problem with it is that she's so inconsistent as a character that you can't even reconcile season 3's Frost with this one. Like, right. There's no way that it's the same person.
Yeah. And I guess killer mindset versus actually being a killer. I still feel like there's like a line there. And like, yeah, I don't know. I just think
I mean,
that
she still has done pretty shitty things that they also don't
done
call
pretty
her,
shitty
so.
Things. You can call her Shitty Frost if you want to. But I don't know that, like, I still don't feel like Killer was ever really earned on her title because they never let her go full villain in the first place. So, yeah. Also, on this week, we have feedback for Flash 604 from Mara. And she says, hello, ladies. I hope you're having a good week thus far. Below are her bullet points for The Flash, which I will not go through all of them, but I will post them all onto Tumblr, hopefully on time. So let's just get started with a couple of these. She says, overall, this episode was miles better than the last one, as the emotional stakes from the first two episodes returned. I want to say that I love this episode, really do, but as an Iris West Allen fan, there was one glaring and persistent problem that soured the episode for me, and it soured it considerably. So to compromise, I will say that I enjoyed this week's outing. The acting TM in this episode. First of all, Sindel Ramamurthy, that is all. His is the performance of the episode for me. He was the only actor in the majority of his scenes this episode, and he was absolutely incredible. The pain, the angst-ridden tension, and Ramsey's descent into a full-blown serial killer due to his desperation were portrayed stunningly by Sindel. I was honestly captivated, but also properly creeped out. Ramsey Russo is rapidly becoming her favorite part of Season 6A. He's such a compelling villain. And when he went after the patients in the oncology ward, I could feel the horror and trauma that Sindel effectively conveyed in his performance. And Barry and Cisco, she says, I love their relationship. It's my favorite relationship on the show after Barry and Iris. And to see them get focused, especially in the first half, was great. Cisco doing everything to try and save Barry, even going behind his back to hide the cure that they planned to give to Ramsey, was so heart-wrenching. Plus the fight between Barry and Cisco. Grant and Carlos are always amazing in these scenes, where Barry and Cisco really go at it. And here is such an explosive moment. Cisco's outcry about having to live in a world without his best friend and his subsequent refusals to accept this were gut-wrenching. Hospital sequence did play out almost like a horror movie, but that still does not justify the episode being billed as a Halloween episode. This was not the Halloween episode. It was an episode of The Flash with some creepy shit going down at the hospital where a serial killer turns cancer patients into zombies, and then those zombies melt into a puddle of their blood. I mean, yikes. But still not Halloween episode. I have not had positive things to say about Killer Frost this season thus far, but I really did like those ice rings that she created on her knuckles to fight. I like that too. The knuckle rings, those are cool. Let's see. Jesse L. Martin was incredible in his scene with Barry, as was Grant. I don't remember the last time there was a scene between Barry and Joe that was this emotional, but this was such a heartbreaking moment between them. Joe's resolve breaking and him saying that he's not ready at all to lose Barry, and Barry telling Joe just how much he means to him. Such a beautiful scene. I don't agree with the big criticism that I've seen on this scene, which is that writers diminished Iris's importance to Barry in order to prop up Barry and Joe's relationship. I genuinely did not get that from the conversation at all, but I do think fans' anger is warranted because of a larger symptom in this episode. And that issue is a strong Black woman trope. God, did this infuriate me beyond belief in this episode. Iris doesn't get to be vulnerable on screen. She doesn't get constant POV or people asking her how she's doing. Instead, she gets people being obnoxious towards her. Ralph was rude, and when all she was trying to do was be helpful and provide him with information on Sue's case, and I was frankly infuriated. Basically, it's like her husband is dying, the love of her life is dying, and this just comes over the course of 6 months after she lost her baby. She's about to lose both loves of her life within 6 or 7 month period. Nobody, and I mean nobody on this damn show, has gone through what Iris is about to go through. It's absurd to me that while she's comforting everyone and putting aside her pain to be strong and put up a strong united front with Barry, not one person turns around and asks how she's doing, which I think is definitely a big part. But thank you, Mara. And again, I'll post the rest on Tumblr because we've got like a lot of feedback. So sweeping into Paulina, who has feedback for Black Lightning and The Flash. For Black Lightning, she really liked this episode. This episode in particular had me stressed, what with Adele manipulating Lynn to take the green line and the ASA taking Tavon into custody. This is how superhero television is done, and I wish more people would watch Black Lightning and see how truly good it is. The fight sequence at the precinct, Blackbird kicked ass, and I was glad that Black Lightning got to get in on some of the action despite the constraints Jeff faced from the ASA. It's basically Henderson, who was absolutely in awe of Vanessa destroying the ASA agents. The Thunder Grace moment was really sweet and had a lot of emotionally poignant, and was a lot more emotionally poignant than their reunion last week. I love seeing how soft and caring Vanessa is towards Grace, and it was also great to see Grace at her most vulnerable. This is what I want more from these two. Dislike, she is very apprehensive about Lynn and wants Lynn to catch a break already. All she wants to do is save these children, and now Odell's drugging her. Somebody please save Lynn now. Meanwhile, over on The Flash, she did think that the acting was great. Carlos, Grant, and Jesse all brought their A game to the emotional components of the episode, while Sinhill was an absolute standout, especially given the fact that he has been acting by himself with no screen partner for many of his scenes while portraying Ramsey unraveling. Glad to see Cisco and Barry's relationship get focused, and thought that Jesse portrayed Joe seeming outwardly okay while inwardly struggling with his devastation was stunningly portrayed. Did not like that the episode was full of man pain with some added hijinks from Nash. To be fair, she'd actually had no real issues with Nash, and is curious to know whether he's searching for the anti-monitor as demonstrated by the episode's final scene. However, I do take issue with the man pain, especially where it comes at the expense of Iris West Allen. Let's see. Get that the show is focusing on each character's grief, and that Iris's grief being the deepest and most devastating is likely being saved for the end, but at the very least, she deserves characters asking her how she is. Instead, the show chooses to focus on Ralph's anger over hearing about Crisis and has Iris comfort him about it after he says hurtful words. After he is hurtful towards her rather than vice versa. Even Ralph's apology to Iris was poorly conceived, as he should have at the very least apologized for being dismissive of her feelings and letting her know that her pain must be unimaginable. They even have Frost follow Ralph and Iris out, only to ask Iris if Ralph is going to be okay. The writing is so tone deaf, it's unbelievable. And then she actually did take issue with the Barry and Joe scene, because this scene simply highlighted the continued disrespect to Iris. We all know how much Joe means to Barry. Barry could have highlighted all those reasons without the writers rewriting their own show. Joe did a wonderful thing by taking Barry in, and he helped shape who Barry is, undoubtedly. But he and Barry did have a contentious relationship because he didn't believe Barry about Nora's murder. Iris was the only person who believed Barry. Iris protected Barry's heart. Iris literally protected Barry from her father's rants whenever he disregarded what Barry said about it and the man in yellow. For the show to have Barry essentially elevate Joe over Iris in a conversation is absurd. Barry only knew Joe because of Iris. They could have had Barry elucidate all the reasons Joe means the world to him without disrespecting Iris and all that she has done for Barry. So that is Paulina's take, and that whole take will go
yes,
on Tumblr
Paulina.
As well. Next up, we have Shank, who has Supergirl feedback. And Shank says, the way that Lena looked at Brainy, bitch, me too. He is a baby. Protect my child forever. They have so much fun chemistry together. This is my crack ship, y'all. I'm going to die with this in a one-person raft. So Shang is on the Brainy-Lena boat. I know the season is most likely about Kara and Lena, but I would like to see the super friends also trying to connect with Lena so she would see that they are all her friends too and not just Kara's. I think that's a good point. Lena being evil is a hate crime on me specifically. Why they gotta do my wife like this? Kara, please get your head up your ass and realize your best friend is already down in the sewers. How am I supposed to believe Kara really thought her best friend with huge trust issues and copious amounts of trauma is all right with her dropping the Supergirl bomb in 2 seconds? Make it make sense. Literally begging. Can we get one man that gets close to Kara and not want to be in her pants? Me literally at any William Kara interaction, and then he has like a picture meme that says, "And I often wonder what I've done in my past life to deserve this. What wrongs have I committed that now force me to suffer this eternal hell?" I feel like that's the entire Supergirl fandom at this point. The only thing that can save William is that he's a fake. His fake wife is a disguise for his closeted boyfriend. I'm not saying that William is a bad guy or even that what he did was unforgivable, but him being a head-ass to women didn't seem necessary to introduce him. Stas is such a sweetheart, but William is testing me. Not saying they'll be a couple, but excuse me if I'm real bummed out about the possibility. My sunshine with trauma deserves more, deserves someone that respects her and is always in awe at her strength. You know, card off, in-game cough. Me too, bitch, me too. And then he offers some news about the Superman show. Shang is on the fence about it. On one hand, I would really like to see a Lois and Clark trying to be parents to John. On the other hand, I don't need another white man show. Phyllis CW is very saturated with superhero shows already, and maybe if their series was for the summer, I think I wouldn't mind it as much. Additionally, we already have a Supergirl, so why do we need a Superman? That's a good point about the summer. If it was in the summer, then it would probably give me something to like drown out like the summer blues of TV. That I could get down with that. Put him in the summer and then everybody will be happy. I agree with you, Shang. Moving on, we have Tasha, who is our Arrow correspondent. She says, another episode spent on season 3. We got Nanda Parbat with a little season 6 Thanatos Guild thrown in. It was nice to have Athena back along with Talia. I'm always a fan of female villains. While I don't care too much about the plot, while I didn't care too much about the plot, the character moments were great, and it really showcased the badass women. Talia, Athena, Lila, Thea, Zoe, and Mia. Her likes, everyone falls from the ceiling in the perfect warrior stance and William face plants. I died. I died too. That was hilarious. Are we certain they didn't transplant some Felicity DNA to him? Because that's seriously her kid. He's so awkward. Also, Thea is back. It's always nice to see her. She's had a great arc throughout the series. I love the scene of her and Oliver sitting on the cliff talking about how their parents drove their heroism. It was a great parallel to the scene in 716 when William and Mia were climbing the wall to the Glades. I also think they did a solid job addressing what Oliver experienced on Earth 2 with regards to Thea's death. He saw a world without a sister, so he's terrified of losing her, and William is all Mia has left, so she's unwilling to risk him. It was nice to see another facet of Mia's personality with the vulnerability she showed William and Zoe. Dislikes. Nyssa wasn't in the episode. Really wanted another face-off between her and Talia. Plus, it would have been a great way to tie in what we saw in the future with her training Mia, but I did appreciate the joke about her being on a beach working on her tan since Katrina Law is in Hawaii filming her new show. Dislike. They killed Zoe. Knew it was coming. Just knew it, but I'm still bitter. She was the first canary since Sarah that I really connected with because her backstory felt fleshed out. We saw how her mother died. She grew up the child of a vigilante and trained by a black canary. Her taking up the mantle made sense, but so her death was heartbreaking. Won't blame Mia because, one, JJ is the worst, and he's the one who killed her. Two, I think that it would take away from Zoe's agency. She made the choice to support her team, and her last act was one of bravery. She saved Mia's life. That being said, Mia made the wrong call on that mission, and her error in leadership will and should leave her feeling some guilt. And I'm going to read her predictions because we always forget them later on. So her predictions is that William told Mia that he believed fate brought FTA together just like it did their parents, and the book Oliver and Thea found mentioned the importance of balance between good and evil. I think the reason the monitor pulled them from their timeline is that Zoe's death and the fact that Connor was about to kill JJ would have thrown off the balance. He is going to use this to teach both Oliver and me a lesson. And then she also thinks this is not the last we've seen of Zoe. She says that maybe we'll see her again in flashbacks, or maybe when the worlds merge in crisis, we get another Earth Zoe, but I think they'll close out her story better than this. Yes. And she also is still of the belief that Oliver doesn't actually really die in crisis. So with Emily Beck coming back for finale, maybe series finale, maybe she's right. So Tasha's usually right. So we'll see. Suarez recap. Good morning, ladies. I'm unfortunately sick at home today. Oh, I'm sorry. But that fortunately means I'm getting my feedback on time. So feel better, Suarez. He says, I was just so befuddled during this week's Supergirl. The character motivations made little to no sense all around, and James's ending in particular was half-baked and awful. Thank you! I will have more to say about this later on. He says, I have no idea where they're going with Nia and Brainy. The writers clearly aren't interested in giving them a substantive and meaningful romantic arc, and I'm truly scared to see how this goes further and think they both deserve better, way better. Also, Lena, my queen, was also written quite nonsensically. I still inevitably stand, however. For The Flash, he says, it didn't really feel like a Halloween episode, to be quite honest. We were totally robbed of seeing the team in Halloween costumes, a true travesty. Ramsey is still a great villain, though, and it's interesting to see how ramped up his arc is, which we typically never have on this show that loves to draw anything and everything. Also, once again, didn't really care much for Ralph's story. And then finally, for Black Lightning, he says that he did enjoy it overall this week. It's nice to see in this and great Grace have some, in my opinion, well-written romantic scenes. Are the writers actually going to give their relationship the screen time and dedication it deserves? I don't think so, but keep hope alive, Suara. He says, I don't like what they had Lynn go through this episode. I think the optics of Odell manipulating her to be addicted to green light are really horrible, and she deserves way better. Thank you, Suara. And then finally, we have Celeste, who says, hello, ladies, hope you're doing well. This week of the Arrowverse shows left me kind of meh, if we're being honest. For Black Lightning, Grace getting a little more screen time. Guess I'm going to take my crumbs before she disappears for episodes like usual. Maybe the writers will prove me wrong this time. I doubt they will. but she's not holding her breath anyway. On Supergirl, it was eh. I don't remember a lot, but I thought James Sinoff Party was well done. I'm going to actually miss him, and I wish he would have gotten proper material all along, but unfortunately he didn't, so I'm going to appreciate the crumbs, I guess. Kelly, Alex, Kara, Iris, and Felicity, my poor children of the Arrowverse, not being able to cook, bless their hearts, at least they try. Lastly, I don't know where the hell they are taking Lena's arc, but I hope it is that there's consequences for her actions and serious character growth, because that ending was worrisome. Knowing episode 7 is where Kara finds out the truth about Lena makes me wonder how this is going to play out in the end. For The Flash, she thought it was better than expected, although Ashley's lack of screen time is bothering me beyond all ends. Her reporter arc is supposed to be on fire right now, and it's not. I'm waiting and seeing, and I'm ready to start seeing if it has more focus. She's talking about my trash son. She says, I'm sorry, Jess, but your trash son bothered me this episode. The fact that Iris was roused, emotional, punching back, infuriated me. I'm tired of her being there for everyone, but no one except Barry occasionally is there for her. The apology at the end would have made more impact if Ralph would have mentioned how he didn't think about how hard it was for her with the news of Barry's impending death, but no, they want to have her hold her feelings in until episode 7 or 8. I am tired, TM. Lastly, on Arrow, not going to comment on anything really aside from the fact that they killed Zoe, and now she's added to the list of women of color being brutally stabbed in the Arrowverse. Yikes. She shouldn't have died, but whatever. It was nice seeing Thea, and the ending was interesting, though. All right, that's it for Celeste, and it for all of our feedback, which will be going up on Tumblr. But now we move into the meat of the podcast, which is the shows. So, as always, we have Superbat and Arrow on side A, A Flash of Lightning and Titans on side B. We talk about what sparked joy, what did not spark joy, our predictions, and crown a lady with gumption of the week. This week, Tati is our host, and she will guide us through this week's shows. Please take it away.
I am your hostess of the mostest, Tatiana, and we are here at side A, Martian Protocol / Feathers in Force / Scavenger Hunt. We begin with Supergirl in plain sight. Kara's investigation into William Day's criminal activities results in the shocking revelation that he is a man who volunteers at a soup kitchen. James and Kelly go to visit their aunt and then forget all about her when they see how wretched their hometown is and how ready McCott is to leave the show. Meanwhile, Alex talks back to her dad, John, but it's only because Malefic incepted her brain before Brainy could stop obsessing over Nia. Lena remains a weirdo, and that's what you missed on Glee. David McWhorter directed the episode, written by Jay Ferber and Jess Cardos. What sparked joy?
Well, there was Nia and Kara investigating, and it was a great team up because they went back and forth the whole episode, and it was weaved really well into the episode. So I love that. Brainy actually talking about his heartbreak over Nia and needing everyone to hear about it, even though no one asked him about it. James not dying. And Jean saying that he believed he was a monster, which is why he was so susceptible to Alex/Malefic's harsh words. And just in general, Kelly continuously being a part of the story throughout all of this Malefic stuff. And the brief moment in which I thought maybe Lena still has a heart and she was telling Brainy kind words. But, you know, that was shattered. So I feel like just in general, no, that's the negative part. Go on.
Okay, you basically stole my likes.
Sorry.
Like, let me borrow your homework, but like make it different.
you can expand more lovingly about on the likes.
I don't really have much to expand though. Like, this episode was shit for me. So like, it's not my favorite episode, but I mean, I did enjoy the investigative duo of Kara and Nia, and I feel like that's what should be happening on The Flash with Iris and her team. Like, that's the kind of screen time or like scenes that I would like to be seeing, especially with like investigative reporting. And I like that, you know, Nia has like context and she's like the girl in the window while Iris, or sorry, I am building up my own fan fiction here where Iris is also investigating with them. But Nia is, you know, finding out leads while and sending out Kara to on the missions, and they have this kind of communication. So I thought that was really one of my favorite parts, like my favorite part of them as a duo this episode. Brainy and Lena, I thought they were also one of the dynamics that I really enjoy. I'm not to Shang's side where I crack ship it, because I've already got my hands full of one crack ship with Kara and Brainy at the moment. So that's where all of my energy is. But I do enjoy Brainy and Lena as friends and as like a dynamic duo. And I think Lena actually enjoyed it too. And when Lena forgot that she was supposed to be an evil revenge murderess taking over the world, she actually had fun. So that was nice to see. Her kind of remember what it was like to actually be part of the team. And then just in general, Kelly continuing to be important to the story and her tie to Malefic. And now it's progressed into visions and she can actually see into his mind and be helpful in trying to catch him. I really enjoy her part in the story. And that's all I can say.
I didn't dislike the episode as much as y'all seem to have. I did like very much John explaining that he believed Alex capable of calling him a monster precisely because he was considering himself a monster there, because I think his self-determinations were believable in this episode, and that they were, you know, definitely made sense for his character and did him justice. I also liked how hard he tried to get through to Malefic. I liked how much Alex was worrying about Kelly, while at the same time, I liked the fact that we actually saw Kelly while she was in seclusion, right? We got to see her and James go off into their hometown, of which I have forgotten the name, and we got to see them react.
Or something?
Sure,
something.
That one. Calvintown, yes. We got to see them react to this, to the changed situation, to reach out to random child, and just in general be active in the plot, especially since it was James's final plot. So I appreciated that there was a fire of purpose being lit under James's ass, so that his exit was not some random, I'm going to go be a politician, like they were trying to set up before that, and also that it wasn't death via crisis, which some of us had been concerned about previous to this. I did think, like, I think it showed him off in the best possible light. Although, of course, there were several problems with the storyline, or just in general, it was, you know, we'll talk about that later. I loved Nia and Kara's investigative team up. It was great to see them doing probably more journalism in that one episode than the entire Arrowverse put together has done in this season so far. So, you know, Kara putting her, like, one work day a year to good use. Also loved how adorable Brainy was being about the Nia situation while Nia was working with Kara. And then he'd be like, oh, is that Nia? Did she talk about me? Like, what's the whatever, you know? Thought that was cute. Also liked that she promised them not to go anywhere, that they would, like, work on their problems together. Loved the Nia and Brainy interactions. Just wish that they had been real. Thanks so much, Lena. Speaking of, what did not spark joy?
I didn't get why they brought up Aunt Vi only for them to not explain why she's gone or where she is. Like, did she die? Did she move away from this shitty town, apparently? Like, at first I wondered if she knew the kids. Oh my God. At first I wondered if she was actually, if she knew the kids were there in her house and that she was allowing them to crash there. I think that would have been a better segue into James wanting to stick around and help, because, you know, her just, I don't know where she went, and them never bringing her up again. It's like, yeah, we had good memories of Aunt Vi, and then Aunt Vi's gone. plus, I was disappointed that it was that James's departure was just so abrupt, because I didn't think it was going to happen in the fourth episode. It seems like they've, I didn't love the whole I'm going to run for politician thing or anything, but they didn't even build up to him leaving properly. Then they dumped everything into one episode and then didn't have even one interview with Macaud Brooks after his big exit, which was super weird. Like, they asked the guy who plays William Day about, like, hey, so Macaud's leaving. He's like, yeah, we never worked together. So that was awkward.
That is so strange.
Yeah. So, like, this guy's leaving, and it's like no one cares. I mean, he had a nice little speech at the end of the episode with his friends and all, and it was nice, but it just didn't feel like an exit worthy of a storyline that should have had a little bit more to it. Brainy suffering on his own about the whole relationship with Nia was a bit frustrating, because no one's really addressed that Brainy shouldn't not be himself. And even Nia saying that she's not going anywhere didn't make me feel better about the status of the relationship, because it's still like, oh, well, yes, the problem is you, not me. And I don't like the fact that no one's still addressing that aspect. Like, is Nia going to be there for him while he changes? Like, is that what's supposed to be happening? It was just a strange setup. And then, of course, Alex being so quick to want to whip out the alien killing machine was so extra and unnecessary. Malefic trying to threaten Kelly aside, she was, like, way too trigger happy, which has become, like, an uncomfortable pattern at this point for her. And then Lena, who is back on her bullshit and past the point of no return, and every episode has just been piling on her storyline, and her using Brainy and Kara and the whole DEO to help with Malefic, only for her to steal Malefic for herself, was wrong on so many levels. So I'm really concerned where they're trying to go with the storyline, because there's absolutely no nuance, like, whatsoever. There's little interaction with Kara and Lena at all anymore. And it just seems like they just keep building this whole Lena is evil that I don't really expect much payoff for it, other than she's just going to be evil and there's going to be no, like, what is the power of love going to save her? I don't see that happening at this point, the way that she's going. But I mean, I didn't hate this episode so much as just I thought it was kind of boring overall, and it didn't really spark too much joy while I was watching it.
Let me give you some of my highlights from my notes for this episode. What kind of Sesame Street bullshit? Whoever wrote this episode should be shot. Like, I did not enjoy this episode much at all. And I wasn't really sure in my notes, like, where to start about what I didn't enjoy about it. Because I wasn't sure, like, what annoyed me the most or the least. And I know that, like, there were some tweets that went viral, including that, like, quoted that clip from Supergirl Twitter of the, like, bad stunts and acting in CGI of John and the team, like, confronting Malefic. And they're like, Superman and Lois, this is Clark, this is your future. But I will call that, and I'll erase you the scene of Kara in Mexico when she's confronted by that wind lady that blows her out the window, and you can clearly see there's a dummy, like, flying out the window. And then later in that same scene, when Kara finally gets the upper hand, she throws, like, a table, and it snaps what is clearly another dummy in half over the table. Like, the legs are, like, lifeless and, like, bent, like, the wrong way, and it's just a whole-ass disaster, that whole scene. And why was Kara in Mexico City practicing her her Peggy Hill Spanish, you ask? Because she's stalking William, because he's clearly up to no good, only to confront him at the end and have William, like, spurn out this whole soup kitchen. He's a really good guy, and it tortured him to have to lie to Kara, a woman that he's never met, and that he would never lie to her because, you know, something. And it's just, like, the setup for this ship is straight out of, like, a Wile E. Coyote episode, where, like, the audience is Wile E. Coyote trying to, like, trap the Roadrunner into actually riding Kara into a loving, healthy relationship. And the Supergirl writers are the Roadrunner dropping an anvil named William Day on her head. And they're, like, running full speed ahead with whatever the fuck they're trying to build here, because I don't know what it is. But, yeah, we are the clowns in this situation. And Kara, it's just, like, the whole final scene where she confronts him, and Kara's like, you're a criminal! And William's like, I'm undercover, and I hate it lying to you. You're so cute, haha. And, like, Kara's like, you're a jerk. William, oh, no, baby girl, I play one on TV. Like, I'm not a jerk in real life. I just play one on TV. You know? Like,
I don't know. Soup kitchens.
Yeah. It's just, like, weird. And, yeah. And then you have James's whole exit storyline, just straight out of, like, a Saturday morning, like, cartoon. Like, I'm just a bill. Like, that kind of, you know, just really cheesy special. Even though I love that. I love that little Saturday morning cartoon. So I'm not going to shade it, but, you know, you know what I mean. But, like, seeing as how this is his last episode ever, this was just the stupidest storyline McCod could have left on. And the sad thing is, I think he probably truly liked it. Like, he probably advocated for this kind of storyline. And it's just not great. Like, I had no idea you could gentrify a city's deterioration, but somehow the Supergirl writers managed to do it. Like, this is, like, the cleanest, squeaky cleanest rundown city I've ever seen in my life, complete with, like, gee, mister, why would anyone like you care about us? Like, little sidekick. And, like, the prison takes over the city and sends its people to 10 years for stealing a $30 heater. Like, at least make your injustice sound believable, you know?
You know what? They were just following Les Mis rules, okay? They're like, loaf of bread, 16 years. Let's go.
Off of your head. Yeah. It's just the whole kind of, that whole storyline was just, like, annoying. And then finally, like, while I know, like, Malefic was responsible for Alex's rude outburst towards John, it did annoy me that she was so gung-ho on trying to get John on board to kill his brother. When she knows good and damn well that if it were her and Kara, and, like, Kara was Malefic, she'd never allow anyone to murder Kara if there's a possibility that she could reach her. So I don't know why she was trying so hard to get John on board with killing him. I lied because I forgot my weekly disapproval of Lena's actions comment, so that's my final one. But you could tell for like a moment that she was genuinely enjoying being part of the team, and I think I probably would have put, like, Lena and Kara's, like, you know, little celebration combo in my likes, except that when she, like, when they yelled cut and Kara left the scene, like, Lena did what she did. So it's kind of like, what is actually her goal? What is the point? If she wants, like, I don't understand what she's doing. So there. That is all.
That was beautiful. Now, like I said, I wasn't as big a hater of this episode as others. But I do have to agree about the sequence of the team confronting Malefic. When that episode opened and that was happening, it was so badly done that I thought it was a dream sequence at first. I really thought, like, oh, Kelly's having a nightmare, or oh, Alex is having a nightmare, or whatever.
That too.
Yeah. And then later on, Alex said something about, like, oh, we did this, but that. And so then I was like, oh, that really happened. Oh, okay. Okay, then. The Mexico scene, also an embarrassment, like you said. It just seems like they're saving their money for Crisis. So let's hope Crisis looks good, because otherwise, what was this for? William is a tragically poor spy. I don't know what he's supposed to be. I don't, undercover journalist, whatever. He's really bad at it. Kara found him out in 2 seconds flat when she can't even bother to do her job 90% of the time. So imagine how quickly Andrea's going to find him out. She probably already knows. She's probably just, like, waiting for him to mess up even bigger. Also, the explanation for his behavior makes no sense. Like, why would Andrea trust him just because he's a snake to his coworkers? It's not like big evil bosses want competition. They want minions. So he should only be doing things that are bad because she asked him to do them. He should be like the Peter, you know what I'm talking about, from Harry Potter. Wormtail. He should be like a little simpering fool that does everything until you're asked to strike. But whatever. He's stupid, clearly. Also, speaking of stupid, is there, like, the confession scene. Like, it was so dramatic. It had so many romantic overtones. I have no idea why. Like you already said, like, does he really like her writing that much? Is he really that distraught to lose her esteem? Like, who is Kara to him that he's so upset about this?
He never even met her.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, obviously we didn't like the way that he was behaving, and it's a terrible, like, how is it a step up? Like, you're like, I'm going to have a real jerk ass and then make him fall in love with Kara and be a changed man, whatever. That'll be her ship. And now they're like, well, this time it's a fake jerk ass. He's going to fall in love with Kara while pretending to be mean to her. I was like, all right, this is not that much better. Please stop. Anyway, as much as I didn't hate the Calvin Town storyline the way that Jess did, I did find it very cheesy and unrealistic. First off, like, how would no one know what is going on in Calvin? That is so extreme. Social media exists. Someone would have tweeted, like, hey, my mom just went to jail for 10 years because she stole a toaster. What? People would know about this. That's ridiculous. Also, where the fuck did Aunt Vi go? Why did neither Olsen twin mention her before? Why did they just, like, stop looking for her after they found the group of, like, squatter rights in her home? Oh. Anyway. Also, Alex wanting to kill Malefic and being, like, so gung-ho about it seemed just so unacceptable. I can't say it seemed unrealistic, though, because it's totally in line with her previous bloodthirsty, like, police violence moments she's had. But the show has never acknowledged as being, like, really wrong. It's just like, oh, Alex is taking a hard line against crime by wanting to kill people. Okay. So I think that would be a great thing to look into, Supergirl, if you want to work on something. And of course, finally, Lena. Nope. I can't believe she manipulated Brainy's trust like that. He's never done shit to her. Can't believe she made me think that they were being cute, even though I knew that I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, and then it did drop. And now I can't believe that now she's going to use Malefic in her plans. Like, how could she be helping humanity? Like, what is she's totally lost the plot by now, basically, is what I'm saying. And it's not fun to watch. It's not like, ooh, look at Lena getting another one up on whoever, you know? It's just like, Lena, please desist. Okay, do we have predictions?
William said that he likes Kara's writing, so I expect them to be a ship.
Write a story together.
The story of their love.
You can share my byline, William.
Yes. I mean, they're going to be working together now more. And he's like, yeah, you can finally let his guard down now. He has somebody he could trust, blah, blah, blah. You know this is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. He's on her byline and in her bed.
Ew. I'm just going to have to hope that Hope is actually altering Lena's brain chemistry. Because otherwise, like, again, like, I don't know where she goes from here. Because it's not up.
I am not echoing. Okay. I agree that her brain chemistry must be altered. And I can only imagine that she's using Malefic to incept that better brain chip into people's heads. So that's all I got. That's what I assume she'll do with him. All right. Moving on to Batwoman. Episode titled, Who Are You? A new villain with an eye for trying to be Catwoman drops in on the city. Kate attempts to find a balance between replacing Bruce with herself and replacing Sophie with a not-so-psychic bartender. Catherine has one run-in with Alice and can no longer take the heat of lying to Jacob. Mary fangirls over Batwoman and plays an easy trick on boyfriend whose name doesn't matter. Meanwhile, Luke has to deal with Batwoman's suit and Magpie's explosive plans at the same time. Holly Dale directed the episode written by Nancy Q and Denise Harcavy. Ooh, are you related to Juliana? Anyway, what sparked joy?
The only thing that I liked about Kate and Reagan's plot is that it opens up the idea of being forced to hide part of your life or not being able to live as openly as, and honestly as you want to Kate, as she's like struggling to balance crime fighting and a love life. And she also like really, really sucks at lying, like super, super bad. But I can't tell if that's because Ruby Rose sucks at lying or because like, Kate sucks at lying. But anyway, I also like that Sophie is still on to her and that she like lets Kate know, like, I'm on to you. And so now Kate knows and Sophie knows. And despite them still being a little bit awkward, they still occasionally collaborate because, as Sophie says, they make a good team. So I do like that at least Sophie's still in Kate's orbit. Reagan's only other use was being like really jealous of seeing Sophie talking to Kate and knowing that she can't even interest Kate in the same in being with her in the same place longer than 60 seconds. So that was cool. And then she left, and that was the best. but like the best storyline in this episode, I think, was Alice versus Catherine, just because Alice is like the most interesting person on this show, and her kind of back and forth with Catherine was the most interesting plot. Kate's plots continue to be like not very interesting. And then the second best part of this episode was Mary, who I think wins Lady of Gumption on for me for getting info out of Alice's boyfriend by pretending to be like pumping him up with morphine and pretending to be her so she could pump him for information. So I like that. And I like that I was kind of slightly off on my prediction or hope for the show of a hero civilian relationship, because it's not Sophie and Kate, because Sophie clearly knows that Kate is Batwoman, but we do get that kind of dynamic between Sophie and Mary, with her coming to Mary and bringing he who shall not be named, or who doesn't matter to have a name anyway, over so she can heal him. And now Mary's kind of in on this cool thing with Batwoman, so I like that, and I hope that that continues. And then she still has her relationship with Luke. So it's like three very separate ends for a triangle that have not connected yet, but you can still see that they're all very clearly involved with Kate and have like an important role in Kate's heroic arc. So that's cool.
All right. So I loved Kate coming to Sophie for help, like how Sophie's face got a bit softer and she let down her guard when or how Kate's face got softer when Sophie said that she knows things have been tense with them, but she's glad that, you know, she came to her because they make a good team. And yes, Sophie continuing to suspect Kate is beautiful to me. And I enjoyed even more that Kate can't really lie about it very well. So that's always great. I like the fact that Kate came to Mary to save Alice's boyfriend's life. And Mary being the one to get some information out of him. It also really proved how much Kate trusts Mary. And, you know, hopefully soon she will find out that she is Batwoman too. But I also liked Mary's reaction because it felt very natural. Like she wanted to help, but she also didn't trust the guy because he almost killed her. So she was still like very suspicious of him, but she also had to take care of him because she was a doctor. And I actually thought they used Martha's pearls a bit more wisely this episode versus how they've been using other Batman related stuff. Like it was worked well into the plot. Catherine finally telling Jacob that she played a big part in why he stopped looking for Beth. I think Catherine, like
deer fragments.
Yes.
Deer fragments.
Well, then she paid off like the coroner's office or something like that to say that they were someone's skull. So fun times. I mean, I would like to know why she did that besides the fact that she thought Jacob would never get over it, but at least they're not dragging out the secrets for a whole season. Plus, we got a bit more emotion from Jacob because he's kind of been blah up until now. And I'm looking forward to seeing like how his relationship with Catherine plays out now that he knows. And I also liked that Kate and Regan, whatever her name is, broke up so quickly because they annoyed me so much throughout all the entire episode.
That is a wonderful like. was that the end of yours, or did I just cut you off?
No, I am done.
Okay. I enjoyed that Kate ditched Reagan four times in the span of 24 hours. And I also enjoyed that Reagan had no idea what was going on. And like you said, that they broke up. All excellent, in my opinion. because I'm a petty asshole. Sophie, looking out for and working with Kate, while suspecting her being Batwoman, Reagan being jealous of Sophie, all of this was pleasant to me. So, and I liked what you said too, Jessica, about how Kate realizing, you know, that sometimes you lie and hide yourself because it's better could open up, you know, the door to understanding Sophie's perspective about things. So that's cool to me as well. This was like my favorite episode for Luke so far. He hasn't really gotten to do much before, but I liked seeing him tinker with the suit. I liked, you know, like how he's constantly texting Kate and pulling her away from her like personal life.
I did like when she was like Kate had to hold her breath in that super Sub-Zero room or whatever, and that's the time that Luke decides to like spill all of his secrets.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So this was he was a lot of fun this episode. And this at the end of this episode is when they decided to go into real estate together or whatever, right? To have like a good front for
yeah. Oh yeah, that's another thing Reagan doing good. Did well. Yeah. Is that yeah? She Kate's like I can use my money for something. Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful. So I like that too. That was nice. I felt like Alice's visits gave Catherine some depth in that she seemed so out of her depth with Alice that I now have to give her the benefit of the doubt that she really was trying to be like helpful when she came up with those bones. I'm like, hey, maybe she is telling the truth. But I also liked that she did tell him something, right? Whether it's a lie or whether it's the truth, she was like, I'm gonna come clean about this so that Alice can't use it against me. And also, maybe because I feel guilty, I don't know. Secrets, what could it mean? So I liked that, and I liked how Jacob reacted to it, that he felt disgusted, he needed time to process it. It's like the most interesting that either of them have ever been. So, success. Mary remains the MVP. Loved that she's a Batwoman fan. Loved that she had the good sense to tie up her assailant, but also was doing her best to save him, because Hippocratic Oath. And then I loved how she jumped right into that Alice roleplay in order to get information out of him. We had to stand. What did not spark joy?
Scrolling. Ruby. I feel like I didn't mind her as much, or I didn't notice it as much, or I tried to ignore it as much in the first couple episodes, but this one she was just really kind of obvious. Like she's just really wooden and mechanical, that a lot of the writing that's supposed to make Kate sound funny or look charming just kind of falls a little bit flat. And her natural voice is so, her natural voice oddly sounds more flat and robotic than the voice changer she uses when she's talking to Mary. Like I don't know why they chose to go like, if you want to be funny, or I guess if you want it to be sound different than Kate, then her voice changer should have been more high-pitched or something. It sounded like Kate to me. It's like, I don't know why Mary doesn't recognize his voice, because it's clearly nothing different from how Kate sounds normally. So, but that's kind of, yeah, I feel like I just noticed it more in this episode. I don't know if it's because this episode focused more on Kate's life or her personal life, but it just kind of felt a little bit flat. Another top dislike is the continued use of Batman to prop this show. Like, I need to start keeping tabs on how many times his name was uttered on the show. Somebody is collecting hella royalties over at the DC department because they mentioned Batman at least like 20 times in this episode. I don't know if like Batwoman writers are trying to like hypnotize us into subconsciously the same way that Odell like manipulated Lynn into taking green light on Black Lightning. Like, are they trying to like manipulate us into thinking that this is, you know, Batman's going to appear sometime soon? Cause they just bring him up constantly and compare him constantly. And then you have Kate talking to Bruce, like in the beginning and the end of each episode. And he's just like this huge oppressive shadow over the show. And we know that he's not going to show up anytime soon. So I really like would prefer that they get away from the constant comparisons to, oh, this is not how Bruce did it, or oh, this is calibrated to Bruce, not you, oh, Bruce never did it this way, da 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 da. Like, just come on, focus on Kate, because that's who the show is about. Yeah, it's yeah, Batman
See, I'm already confusing myself where this is Batwoman or Batman show. So I feel like it's starting to work now. But, so that's why I need them to stop. Who else needs to be stopped is Miss I Can Read People, except when they're trying to ghost me, Reagan. Because she was kind of, you know, she did her part in leaving, but the parts where she stayed were just not my favorite. Magpie was lame villain. The bomb necklace was even more lame because, like, you have, like, Kate rushing to save people from explosions that had all the force of, like, Pop Rocks. These, like, tiny little CGI explosions. I'm like, that might cause a mild irritation to me, but I'm pretty sure I would be fine. And Kate didn't have to, like, rush and, you know, cover all of the bombs. And I get this, her cape, like, bomb-proof or whatever. Like, she's, like, covering all of the bombs. I don't really know. But it didn't really seem that, like, there's that much tension or the stakes weren't high enough for me to believe that people are going to die from a little Pop Rock bomb. So, you know, like, I know the CGI budget is small, but that was just, like, come on. Yeah. And Dear Fragments, again. Catherine trying to, like, double down on, like, hiding and the fact that Jacob was fooled by Dear Fragments' goals. Yeah. That's it.
Yes, Magpie was the most forgettable person ever. She's just like a petty thief. I feel like they were trying to go for a Catwoman vibe and failing miserably.
Right.
Kate attempting to learn how to balance a life and being Batwoman would have been more comical if she actually had a personality. I feel like every time they tried to make her like cute, it's like, oh, my sneeze. Oh, my thing didn't work. Like, it just, I don't know what it does. It falls flat for me, and I have a hard time believing that this is all a learning curve for her because she's been supposedly training for years and she can't even, like, get basic things to function. It just makes no sense. Reagan and Kate in bed together at the beginning of the episode was like the show missed a whole step in their relationship. And then it went by so fast that by the time they broke up and, like, Reagan shed those melodramatic tears, the only thing I could do was laugh. I'm like, you've only been together for, like, a day. Why are you crying? You've been on one date. This makes no sense.
She really is petty.
And she's like, I thought this could be a thing. Like, seriously, she's Patty. She's Patty 2.0, except, like, worse, because literally only one date. And then I don't understand, like, why the fuck does Kate not seem to care that a man is rotting and dying in her basement because she's not giving him any food or water? Like, sure, he's Alice's boyfriend. He's a bad guy, whatever. But Bruce having done it is not an excuse. And then she acted so nonchalant about it, too. Just like, oh, yes, I guess he really does need a hospital. It's like, no shit. So that irritated me. And just in general, I just feel like this show doesn't have much of a personality. I know it's primarily because the writing isn't that great, but also Ruby Rose isn't that great. And the show stands on her shoulders and she's unable to carry, you know, the whole storyline because it's believing her as Kate Kane is hard.
Alice carries the story, like the show, for me.
Yeah.
Very true.
For sure.
All right. Is it my turn?
It is.
Okay. So, for me, this episode wasn't bad in the way that Batwoman episodes are usually bad. It was just, like, really boring. It was super, it was, like, their first attempt at a procedural episode, I feel, and they should just not do it ever again. Please. Like, Magpie was such a lame villain. I can't believe we're supposed to take her seriously, especially after 3 weeks of, like, a prolonged Alice storyline to then step down into this, like, you know, girl throwing tiny explosive beads that barely make a dent was just not it. So, speaking of those, you know, the bomb necklace, the last bomb that went off, like, was reasonably strong. You know, when she saved the girl and then the thing explodes, and you're like, okay, that could have done some damage. So it would have been better if we just hadn't had the other tiny ones of, like, little sparks, like little tiny firecrackers. Because then that just made it seem like, why are you running, Kate? It will be fine. So they should have just left it at, like, one. But anyway. Aside from that, the Reagan-Kate relationship had no business moving as fast as it did. Like, normally I would be like, Reagan, you have no right to be, like, expecting Kate to be, like, more open and, like, whatever. Because, like, you literally just met yesterday. But I'm more shocked at how stupid Kate's lies were. Like, you know, you said, like, I don't know if it's that Kate can't lie or that Ruby can't lie. And it's not that Ruby can't lie, it's that Ruby can't act. But
yeah,
the lies.
That's what I meant.
The lies themselves are just dumb. Like, what do you mean the water main? What do you mean an electrical fire? Like, this was a situation where just telling the truth would have been so much easier, you know? Like,
I have a all work you had... I gotta go to work. Thanks.
Exactly.
Bye.
I have to go to work, A. And then in the latter half, I'm handling, you know, these very important necklace that was my aunt's for this charity event. And someone stole it. I have to go take care of this. You know, like, it's very, very easy. She's not going to be asking questions about what's wrong with your cousin's building if you just give the most reasonable version of the truth. Anyway, Ruby Rose was, if possible, even worse at acting this week than she was before. I think, like, in episode 2 or 3, I was like, there's some improvement. I have hope. Oh, boy. But then in this episode, my friend, actually, she really liked Ruby in Orange is the New Black. And so when I said that she didn't make a good Kate, she was offended. And she was like, no, but I really like her. Like, I think she can act. And so then she was watching the episode with me, and then she was like, oh, my God. And it was literally, like, after, like, the first scene, she was like, I take it back. This is terrible. So, yeah, that's how poorly she did. Okay. Predictions?
I don't have any.
I think we have Alice's train. Like, we're going to see flashbacks of what happened to Alice in between.
Yeah.
Next week?
Next
so
week.
So I'm guessing, yeah, whoever did that to Alice is going to have some, like, long and storied history with Bruce. Because, of course, they are. Because everything is
yeah.
Important. Oh,
everybody
yeah, I can see that.
Back to Bruce. Yeah. So I can see right. That.
Moving on to Arrow. Episode Leap of Faith. Reunited and it feels so good. Oliver and Thea remind us that Arrow used to be a good show. They return to Nanda Parbat and they hang out with the inferior Rachel Gold sister, Talia. I almost forgot her name because that's how inferior she is. Anyway, they have some name searching, some betrayal, and some power lady team ups. John and Lila are the most romantic they have ever been while they partner on a special ops mission. Meanwhile, the future still sucks. And Zoe probably dies. Thanks, Mia. Unless the Elicity babies being transported to the present with their dad somehow saves her. Katie Cassidy directed the episode written by Emilio Ortega Aldrich and Elizabeth Kim. What sparked joy?
Thea sparked joy. Seeing her again. I don't think her comeback was as great as I probably envisioned in my head, but then again, it never is on these shows. So for what she got, it was really good. I liked the fact that she really has grown up a lot, you know, like for a younger sister, Oliver still looks at her and sees the need or has the need to protect her a lot, and he can't let go of that. So I really liked their very mature conversations about growing up and their parents and not needing Oliver to protect her in the way that he's been protecting her before, because she's obviously able to take care of herself and she seems like she's in a good headspace, and I love that for her. So all of that was great. I really like the fact that we actually got to spend some time with Diggle and Lila, because that never happens on the show. She's always like in and out, and like they rarely get moments of actual relationship growth or anything like that. So to see them actually be on a case together, working a case together, discussing the upcoming crisis, all of that was great. And I really like the action scenes. I didn't like this episode as much as you guys probably did or didn't. That's all.
I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't get to see this episode until like last night because I just had like a crazy work week. I thought it was okay. I feel like the final season of Arrow feels a little bit lackluster overall. Although I guess it's not sparking joy, so let me switch gears.
Yeah, spark some joy. Come on.
Sparking joy. I did like Thea coming back, and that she's not the kind of... She's a different version of Thea, and that she's obviously grown in a lot of her time since she's left. And I thought that they had really good scenes together between Willa and Steven, and that Oliver is still at his heart, even though she's grown so much, even though she's been through all of these experiences. At the end of the day, she's still his little sister. And so he's still very kind of protective of her, but she's also grown. So I like that she was also like, I am not just the little girl that you knew. And then she kind of pushes back a little bit when he's trying to push her away to protect her. She's pushing back because, you know, someone's got to look after you, Oliver. So I like that they had each other's back in that sense. Even if they're like butting heads over having each other's backs. I liked William and Nia's. I really did like the face planting. Like William just like landing straight on his face with everyone around him. I thought that was hilarious. I do like, I guess I did like the conversation between Nia and William and her actually showing a second emotion and breaking down about her fear. I like that Zoe introduced that concept of not being ruled by fear and her trying to explain to Nia not to go head into things. I liked all the Dyla scenes. And the introductions that Connor's mother is actually Sandra Hawk. So at least we get her in some kind of way, even if it's not comic canon, the way that her story is introduced. But at least Connor Hawk's mom is still Sandra Hawk, so I guess that's good. And how all of the Dyla scenes played out with John and Lila, and how there's this now that we know that Lila is Harbinger and that she's working with the monitor from last week's episode, we have this kind of extra layer underneath all of their scenes, because we know something and Lila knows something, but John doesn't know. And so, and while he's in this kind of romantic mode, because he's thinking that the world is going to end, we don't really know, and he's seen how Earth 2 played out. And he just really wants her to know that he loves her. And all the while, she is probably kind of been in on it from the beginning. New Earth 2 was going to die or has been more privileged, more information than he knows. And how she's playing off of him and his feelings and not being able to be completely honest with him, even though the world is ending in 6 weeks. So I did appreciate all of that. And that was probably my, outside of Oliver and Thea bonding and this kind of new normal situation, that Diggle and Lila scenes are probably my favorite.
This was definitely my favorite of the farewell tour so far. Not necessarily my favorite episode of the season so far, although I don't know if I had one, but the Oliver and Thea part was my favorite. Their relationship was the most beloved part of Arrow's early years for me, and I loved how we explore the dynamic in this new situation. We see that Thea no longer needs her brother for protection, that he is shaken by what he saw on Earth 2, and therefore he is overzealous in that protection, but that they both, you know, still just generally want each other to be safe and happy, and that they were able to kind of, like, look back on their life so far as a retrospective and talk about their parents and talk about what they've done for each other and how they've grown and how they've matured. And I love that it seems now like Thea is someone who can impart wisdom to Oliver. When in the early seasons, you know, that was very much not the case. I was surprisingly entertained by Talia. I liked the idea of her and Thea turning the Justice or the League of Assassins into a heroes or a League of Heroes, although that title, you know, needs help. Meanwhile, John and Lila's relationship, usually it just exists somewhere in the background of the Arrowverse for me, and I don't have any feelings for it. But in this episode, I think it really showed off their best sides. How well they work as a unit. It was great that we finally got, or they finally got to meet Sandra Hawk and Connor. So now we're going to like see the steps that it'll take for them to adopt him. And I liked the carpe diem feeling, like that the potential end of all the universes, they may as well like jump in, right? Like if they die together or whatever. I like that. And I even like that John was more cautious about what they were doing at first, because of what he had seen in Earth 2, makes sense. And yes, the tripping, William tripping after everyone else landed epically was super cute. What did not spark joy?
What did not spark joy? A lot of things. Mostly like, yeah, everything else. So Mia is garbage, that is all. I can't stand her. She still makes no sense to me. Zoe dying because of her thinking she can play leader and failing miserably was atrocious. I don't like that Zoe was just trying to get her to see sense and then chime in, and Mia dismissed her every which way. And I dislike it even more that Zoe will be Mia's lesson in team building and being a leader or whatever. So when she sees her dad and they discuss the pitfalls of leading a team and growing as a vigilante or whatever, she's gonna have to use Mia's death, or sorry, Zoe's death as, you know, a stepping stone to that, and I do not like that at all. Mm-hmm. Especially when Zoe's always tried to help her and Mia's been so bratty and bitchy towards her. I can't stand her. Thea and Oliver knowing more Arabic than Talia, who grew up reading and writing it. It's fake. First of all, to that Anon who asked on Tumblr, yes, Thea was reading the page the wrong direction. So Arabic is read from right to left, and I don't have to have a screenshot of the actual page to know it probably didn't say what they actually thought it said. This show has not bothered to cast actual Arabs in any of the Ghul roles, so I don't expect them to get the Arabic language right either. And also, again, why is the Arab guy in the Dila storyline the terrorist in the plot? Like, I'm very tired. Was he an actual Arab guy? I don't think he probably was, but he was, like, based on, like, what his dad's name was, it did sound Arab to me.
Well, I mean, like, the...
I didn't look him up, so I don't know.
So I was going to say, that'd be really telling if when it's time to cast terrorists, they get actual Arab people.
Yeah, I mean, that's usually the case. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I will double check. But I'm just very tired of, like, this lazy and stereotypical writing when it comes to Middle Eastern people in TV and movies, so please stop. And then in terms of, like, Oliver and Thea, like, I liked their bits in Nanda Parbat and, like, their conversations in general, but I feel like there was a lot of wasted time looking up the monitor and his history, and it didn't feel like the plot moved except to get to the next location that Oliver will probably go and visit on his next part of the farewell tour. So it feels like these episodes are stalling, like they're not going anywhere relevant to me. And then the ending was very confusing because I had to rewind it twice. So the blinding light happened so abruptly, and then all of a sudden all the future kids are in the present, and I still don't understand whether it was like the monitor's trick or something something else that happened that I missed in the two times that I saw it, but I don't like it. I thought it was weird. And then Dinah and Renee have yet to discuss their feelings about the crisis or even have any actual screen time. And I still don't like how they've been sidelined completely. And given the fact that now Zoe is gone and maybe Mia will have to tell Renee that, I don't like where this is going.
Yeah, it's very... I think that was kind of like Dinah and Renee not having any screen time or any kind of meaningful screen time in two episodes out of, what, three or four? Or no, this is three. So, like, two of the three episodes, they have not shown up at all or had any kind of, like, screen time. There's no kind of storyline tying back to actual Star City and what actual Star City is doing and seeing how we are headed towards the future. You would think they would still want to build up to where we originally started in 2040 and how it got that way. It's just kind of odd that they've been out of action. And now in this episode where Zoe gets killed, and if it is the monitor, he sure picked a hell of a time to take all the kids out, because you could have done that before she got killed, and then, you know, we wouldn't be suffering. But yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. And what I was talking about earlier is this is the final season of Arrow, and it does feel like it's stalling. It feels a little bit lackluster. This is the last time we're going to see any of these characters. A lot of it is like work leading up to Crisis, but it's like not exciting at all. It just feels like it's spinning its wheels. And so, you know, thinking about this is the last time we're going to see these characters, it's not the best season, really, in my opinion. I think that over in the Talia story, like, I totally agree. Like, having Talia need to be read Arabic by Thea, like, Thea reads Arabic to Talia, and then Talia's like, what does that mean? And then Oliver explains what it means to Talia. You, like, have these two white people telling this Arab woman about her own history and her own culture. Talia losing to Thea and then humbly joining. Oh, even though I've betrayed myself and I've betrayed you and I've done bad things, you'll let me join as co-captain of the League of Heroes? It's just like, it's not because I don't like Thea, but I just think it's just overall, it's like a little bit ridiculous. It's like, colonialist almost. And
oh my gosh,
like, these two white people bringing in like the colonizers, bring like beating her at her own history, her own culture, her own game. She's been training like her whole life. Her whole life has been in this part. But you know, it goes back to even Malcolm becoming like the head of the demon. All of this, it and her being made to be like humble and like, oh, thank you, Thea, for letting me join, and thank you, Oliver and Thea, for teaching me like life lessons. It just doesn't really sit well with me, in a general sense. Yeah. And then similarly, when you need like a bad guy or a villain, again, it's time to call like the Arab terrorists and like the dial-up plot. Is it necessary? Yeah. Because I feel like they could have done any kind of normal villain that got his dad got murdered, and it would have been the same thing. So I don't really see like the need for another Arab terrorist plot over in the future. Mia's leadership skills are trash, and the fact, I don't know where she gets all this like unearned confidence that her way is the right way when she has never done anything in her, like in her life like that. The whole fact that when they are proposing what to do about the Deathstrokes, and she's just like, let's barge face in, let's just charge and destroy all of them. We're only four people, and actually three, because only three of us can fight, and we're just completely outnumbered, but let's head in there, head strong. And they're like, but that didn't work out last time. She's like, oh yeah, but we know the layout now. I'm like, bitch, they do too. That's their house. That's where they live. I'm pretty sure, even though you know the layout, they still have home team advantage. So, like, the fact that they all just went along with this stupid plan, and the fact that even as Mia had doubts in the moment that what they were doing was the right thing, and they still went through it, and her decision to lead the team into this stupid fucking plan is what gets Zoe killed. It's infuriating because Zoe, it's not like Zoe got really a lot of screen time or story time to begin with. And so the fact that they've always had her at odds with Mia, and the fact that she was correct and then she still dies for it anyway, and it's kind of like a meaningless death, because like, you don't even get the shock and awe of, oh, Zoe died. But then you kind of like trump it by bringing this white light and bringing the kids back to the present. And it's kind of like, what did her death mean then? You know, because you don't even give her time, her death time to make sense in this episode before you add this other fantastical, tiny-whiny mumbo-jumbo and bring them back to the future. And so now, like, the next episode, like, the whole shock and awe on what's going to happen is because these kids are in the present and not because Zoe died, and how do we move on from it? So it just feels like, what was her death worth? Like, what was the point? Somebody tell me, because I don't know.
What is the point indeed? That is what I want to know. I absolutely agree with you. I hate how things turn out for Zoe. I hate that like half of Renee's storyline in this entire show goes down the drain with Zoe dying, and that we're not even, like, we don't even see his reaction to it, or, you know, who knows if we even will. And because Mia is an asshole who doesn't listen to her team. And I totally understand what Tasha's saying. It's like not directly Mia's fault. Obviously it's JJ's fault. But even furthermore, how much do I hate that? How is it possible that John and Lila's child turns into JJ, who kills Zoe? Again, also, the only thing that John has ever done outside of be Oliver's bodyguard. Down the drain. So anyway, I hate all of this. I also don't understand why the kids were taken back in the present. Like, I don't understand what they're going to do for the next four episodes. How can... why would they be relevant enough to the coming crisis that the monitor would do that? Aside from just, like, to make Oliver feel better. But will he feel better? He'll just be distracted by his children and his friends' children. And it just feels like it was done so they don't have to flash back and forth anymore. which is just like cheap and weird and unnecessary. And this is me beating a dead horse that no one else cares about, but like, where is Roy? Why isn't he with Thea? What is going on? Hello? Okay. I'm glad she didn't die, and I'm glad that presumably they didn't break up, but hello? Okay. Totally agree about, you know, the colonialism element of white people taking over the League of Assassins. But the League of Assassins has always been weirdly white to me, like, from Ross, who even, isn't it some white dude?
Yeah, the actor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, whatever. And also Malcolm Merlyn. So, like, this is just, like, nothing new for me. But I agree with you. That you're totally right. Now, the whole ancient scroll business and, like, oh, the person who's like, oh, he's gonna bring out the end of the world. Like, this just, like, felt like such, like, a filler episode, like a MacGuffin situation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't really mean anything that we found this scroll. And, you know, this whole, like, debating about, like, is the monitor really a good guy or a bad guy? Like, am I doing the wrong thing by working with him? But I know I'm going to keep working with him because we're going to get to Crisis. It just feels like a waste of time for me because we already know. Like, I know. Like, not everyone knows, obviously. If you don't know Crisis, you don't know. But, like, we already know that the anti-monitor is a bad guy and a monitor is a good guy, even if his methods are questionable. So it's like, yeah, sure. Maybe the person that was being talked about is the anti-monitor and not the monitor. But, like, if that's the reveal, I'm not... Oh my god, I'm so excited to learn the thing I knew. So, you know, it's not that exciting. It's kind of tiresome. And yeah, finally, where's Nyssa, the superior sister? Hello? And since I can't say, I know Athena was there, and I know that there was fights relating to Athena, but I could not now produce information about what Athena was doing there. So
I forgot she was in the episode.
Yeah. So I guess that's also a not sparking of joy. Prediction?
Oh, I just had like a prediction based on an interview that the actor that plays Connor, is his name Joseph or something? Joseph something?
Joseph.
Let's get Joseph had an interview as Connor, and he was talking about Crisis and how it's going to change everything in the last episode, the whole fallout. And so I'm thinking that after Crisis, and you know, because he was talking about Crisis affects the future and how it changes. I feel like Connor is going to be the new Deathstroke leader after Crisis and not JJ. So they're going to flip that. And then for the whole Green Canary spinoff, Connor as Deathstroke will be the first like season big bad. And then that is actually a better lovers or enemies to lovers thing since Mia will know that Connor is a good guy, but Connor
she'll save him with the power of love.
She has to save him with the power of love. So good luck to her because that seems like it's going to be hard to do. Yeah.
I mean, I love predicting that people will save other people with the power of love, as you all well know. So I am totally on board with this prediction. Meanwhile, I have to hope that the monitor, for some reason, somehow saved Zoe, or that somehow the future can be changed so it's not so shitty, or that somehow Crisis will bring her back to life, or change things so that she's now alive again after, because it was just such a shitty way for her to go that I would just be really pissed if that's not the case. Any prediction from you, May?
Renee will find out in the present that his daughter dies and will try to prevent it from happening.
And that's why he becomes like evil mayor of the Glades.
Ooh, that means he succeeds. I love it. Y'all are the best. Okay. Lady with Gumption nominations for side A.
I already said Mary.
I agree with you.
Mary's
totally
a good one. From Supergirl, was there one? Oh, I guess Kara for investigating, going in deep with investigating William.
Yeah.
Okay. For Arrow,
just is like okay. Arrow, Zoe for saving Mia, even though she didn't deserve it.
All right, I guess.
And Thea. I mean,
I was gonna say Thea, but I've
yeah,
because it was her episode. So.
I'm surprised Tati didn't say talk about her queen. So
my queen, disappointment. Thea? My queen, Thea queen.
Yes.
That is, in fact, my lady with gumption for Arrow. So I have nothing to say, though, just that she's so mature and beautiful. A tropical fish. She's grown so much. She's gonna white savior the Eco Assassin. Anyway. No, I would rather, you know, she sets off into the sunset with Roy, but since he couldn't be here, colonizing the Leo's Athens is.
Is he coming best. Back at all?
We heard they he is. Was.
Well.
Anyway, so shall we move on to side B?
We shall.
All right. Mistake you can't fix / fatigue / half truth. Starting with the Flash episode, There Will Be Blood. Barry's efforts to prepare Cisco for crisis by saving Ramsey's life because 2 + 2 = 5 lead to the theft of science, but no bro hugs. Meanwhile, Iris worries about Ralph's feelings while no one worries about hers. And the only remotely Halloween thing about the episode is the zombie creatures that Ramsey Rosso creates when he's throwing a tantrum. Jesse L. Martin gives us a masterclass in acting, while the writers remind us they don't know an iris. Marcus Stokes directed the episode written by Lauren Cherto and Sterling Gates. What sparked joy?
Okay, so I think, like, there is a lot of Cisco and Barry content and even Joe and Barry content that I think was emotional and had, like, the gravitas to kind of pull the emotional heartstrings that were missing in the previous episode. Cisco and Barry's relationship, it's, you know, he is, like, after Iris, Cisco is Barry's best friend, so it was nice to see them getting some time together and Cisco kind of being on, like, the denial train about it, and Barry coming up with this kind of way for them to work through his not being there by doing better for mankind. It seems like a very Barry thing to do. And I even liked Nash Wells' kind of interruption into their bro moment by, you know, taking advantage of you scratch my back, I scratch yours. I thought they had a lot of fun in their scenes. And I think Grant specifically was very expressive in his, like, Barry's frustration and annoyance. It's like, who is this guy? What? Like, ugh. Like, you could tell he was, like, really kind of overacting, like, Barry's, like, exasperation of trying to work with another Wells. And I think overall, like, their scenes, that whole sequence with the trio of them was a lot of fun. The whole Cisco and Barry argument, I think there's, like, a lot to unpack with Cisco being okay with stealing from someone else if it meant saving Barry's life, and Barry's, like, it's like, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. Like, the horrible part. Like, I'm just disappointed in you, man. And it was, like, worse than actual yelling. And then I know, like, that we've gotten in our feedback two sides to the whole Barry and Joe scenes and situation. And I get where a lot of people are coming from and feeling that was it necessary to stay before the team, before Iris, it's you, Joe, kind of thing. For me, the way that I took that scene was that if it was not for Joe, even if Barry and Iris were best friends, if Joe had decided not to take Barry in, then that would be it for Barry. Like, there would be, he'd go into the foster system and his life could be completely different. So I think while he and Iris have been best friends, and that she played a very large role in believing in him and having faith in him, shaping his why he wants to be a hero and his belief in the impossible. Joe had a role as, like, a father figure in his life and kind of showing him and shaping him in the absence of Henry being in jail about what it means to be a man and what it means to stand up for what's right and things like that. So I really feel like they were hitting at it from that angle. Maybe they didn't say it as eloquently as they should have, but I do think that that's way they meant it. And Jesse L. Martin, I think, in that scene played it really raw and really beautiful. And the way that he broke down, that was like the most heartfelt part of the whole thing, like watching him kind of break down. And also because from Joe's side, in season three, when he found out that Iris was going to die, he was upset. Upset just in general, but also upset the team. And people are saying, like, you know, maybe he wasn't as upset when Iris was going to die as he was when he found out that Barry was going to die. But even though that there was this thing that Iris is supposed to die in the future, it's not a future that was set in stone. So there's still this possibility. And also the one person that could save his daughter's life is the Flash. And it just so happens the Flash is in love with his daughter. So you've got that. He's also got his son, who is a speedster, who would do anything to protect his sister. So now that's two speedsters on the team. And then you have this whole team of nerds that are working around the clock to save his daughter. So you have this whole, like, support group of people that, even though you have this one kind of potentially tragic future, there's still some kind of hope that she could be saved. And then that compared to this situation with Crisis and Barry, the only person that can save Barry from Crisis is Barry, and Barry doesn't want to do it. So then what is left? Like, Barry is saying that there is no other option. There is no team of nerds to figure out how to save Barry from this situation. Barry doesn't want to save Barry from the situation. So that's kind of it. Like, that's the end of the road. And so I feel like his breakdown in that sense kind of made more sense, because what do you do when the person that can save Barry is Barry, and Barry's saying that I can't save Barry? So I felt like that was really portrayed well in that. This was kind of like a episode to me, but I think that those were the two, like the Barry and Cisco, and then the Barry and Joe elements. The Ramsey, you know, Sinhale can act, so that's cool.
Noted
that I was in the like that he can act. I did like the ice knuckles, so good on you, special effects guy.
Are those all your likes?
Probably.
That was really well put about the whole Joe Barry scene, because that's basically how I took it as well. But before I get to that, I do want to congratulate Killer Frost on not getting knocked out in a fight. So kudos. But just in general, I feel like I probably liked the Ramsey stuff more than you guys did, in terms of the continuing themes of death being the enemy. How far will someone go to save their own life versus, because like you have Ramsey, who's a doctor and has spent his entire life trying to save people's lives, and that's what he thinks his purpose in life is. But then when he's faced with his own death, he's only thinking about himself. Versus Barry, on the other hand, who's like, no, we should save this one person, because he took that whole, I think it was Joe who said it to him, is like, you can't always save everyone, but you can always save someone. So like in the last few weeks of his life, he wants to be able to say that he saved someone from potentially going full villain, even though that never works, but he tried anyway. So like, I like that dynamic. And then I think this is like the first time that Cisco has gotten a storyline where he's gotten to be really emotional, because the last time I feel like it happened was in, like, right after Flashpoint, and he was mad at Barry for doing Flashpoint, and then that resulted in like his brother's death. So he's like mad at him for a while, and I feel like this is the first time in a long time that we actually get to absorb Cisco's feelings about something, versus like him and his half-ass storylines in the last 2.5 seasons. And I feel like he has so much heart, and you can completely understand where he was coming from. Like, he was going through the different stages of grief, and I feel like his storyline in this episode really paralleled Iris's storyline in episode 2, whereas she was in denial and she wanted Barry to fight, and then she kind of accepted the fact that he wasn't really going to, and what are they going to do next? So this is where like Cisco was coming from in that sense as well. So he was like in denial, also going through sort of accepting that Barry was just not going to be saved or whatever. So all of that stuff was great. And I like the idea of like the lesson not coming outright. Like, it came later where Barry's like, I just wanted to you know, show you how being a leader is like making tough decisions and not always decisions that benefit people that you necessarily love, but other people as well. So I liked all of that. And then I'm mad that they kind of cut out the hug scene, but there you go. Then there's, of course, the Joe and Barry scene, which was so good and so heartfelt. I cried twice. And I think that basically what Jess said, that without Joe, even though, yes, they had a contentious relationship prior to him becoming the Flash, I think that Barry has grown so much in the sense that it's been so many years that this was him kind of acknowledging all the things that Joe has done for him in his life, because before it wasn't, that wasn't the case. And they both come to like very, they've reached a different stage in their relationship now than they had been before. And that's how like I took it, in terms of like him being grateful to Joe for all of those things, and, you know, being a good role model and not him being out on the streets and all that stuff. So it's like all of that stuff was implied. And yes, maybe they could have worded it a little bit differently, but it didn't bother me as much as it did other people, because I don't feel like it necessarily undermined Iris, even though she had like less to do in this episode. So yeah, it was just very emotional, and those like scenes really saved the episode in general and made for like a solid outing in terms of like compartmentalizing the team's reactions to Barry's looming death and whatnot.
It's me, I'm other people. Anyway, I also really liked the Barry and Cisco stuff. I thought Carlos really knocked it out of the park, and Cisco was like the one character that consistently made sense to me in this episode, because like of course he would react the way he did. I agree with what you said, that it was paralleling Iris's reaction and the way that Barry and Iris had dealt with it together in episode 2. They kind of went through it in this one, and it was also powerful because we have such a strong bond between Barry and Cisco, and we've seen that relationship grow, you know, and become close, become strong. We know how much they both value each other. So it was really nicely done. And I was totally on his side at first in terms of like, A, like refusing to be satisfied with Barry just letting himself die, and also not understanding how saving Ramsay would be a consolation. I was right there with you, Cisco. But anyway, both their like fight and then their makeup scene were really beautiful to me. I mean, or you know, the fight wasn't beautiful, but it was like really compelling. And then the makeup scene was really beautiful. And even Frost's advice to Cisco in the episode was a nice touch, you know? I thought that, I was like, yeah, that's true, Frost. Speaking of which, she held her own finally in a fight. Even if it was like one against nameless undead creatures, but still, it was like one of our feedback said, was that, you know, the ice knuckles were cool. So it was like, it was cool to actually see her, you know, get creative with her ice powers and actually be useful in a fight. And of course, that sequence overall was interesting. Like, I was glad that Barry had to come face-to-face with the reality that that Ramsay can't be saved. And I like how we continue to parallel Barry's selflessness with Ramsay's selfishness. Iris trying to help Ralph find Sue, I thought was really sweet. And it also paralleled Barry trying to convince Cisco to save Ramsay, because we're seeing that both Barry and Iris are doing that selfless thing and are trying to find, like what Joe said, right? You can't always save everyone, but you can always save someone. They are both products of the environment that is Joe West. So it makes sense that they approach these kinds of situations in similar ways. Also, I did like that Ralph apologized to Iris, since that is a rare occurrence, and that her actions had some kind of effect on him. I also, even though I did not like him being a rude ass and snapping at her, I did like the words that he said regarding spending time with Barry, because that's the only way in this episode that we had any proof that it would be a forthcoming storyline for Iris to be dealing with the fact that she will not get to spend time with her husband in the near future. Second to finally, I forgot about Nash when I was writing my notes or when I was thinking about the episode, but I did enjoy his interactions with Barry and Cisco. I continue to feel like this is like a nice, like more toned down version of the Wells caricature. I feel like his little tricks, like when he was like getting away from the guards or whatever, you know, and showing the boys the way to the serum, like, were actually useful. Like, they worked. They weren't annoying or stupid. And I'm interested in his, like, pursuing of the monitor or the anti-monitor. Like, the fact that what he's looking for is directly related to Crisis and directly related to one of the monitors, I think it's pretty cool. So I look forward to where that goes. Now, finally, Jesse L. Martin, an actor. I definitely teared up in the Joe and Barry scene. I love seeing, you know, the reminder of just how important they are to each other, how Barry has, or how Joe has shaped Barry's life, but also vice versa. I even liked that moment of Cecile, you know, like, pressing Joe's hand in her 30-second scene and knowing that he needed time alone with Barry. Like, at that, like, that's just, like, a nice touch of both, like, her powers and then how she uses her powers, right? Like, that's the kind of thing that she does with them. And also just the relationship that she and Joe have, all of those 30 seconds where she didn't say shit. So I like that. But yeah, I was really moved by the scene. I thought that they deserved to have a nice lengthy scene, that Joe deserved to have that breakdown on screen and be comforted by Barry. And yes, I was annoyed by elements of it, which y'all have already, you know, discussed not being annoyed by, but I will discuss being annoyed by them later. Okay. What did not spark joy?
Okay. So here's the thing. Watching The Flash in season 6 for Iris fans is like playing the stock market. Like, you put so much of your energy and your time into this show, quote unquote, stocks, based off of preseason information of Eric being the new showrunner. You've got Candace being happy. You know, Central Cee season's going to be on fire. She's hiring employees with an S, and all this kind of stuff. And the first two episodes, you get a pretty good return on your investment, so you're fine. You got a really nice Iris content. You got a really nice West Island content, so that's cool. Then episode 3 happens. You know, it's okay. It's just like a small dip. They can't all be winners, you know? So you just shrug it off. But then episode 4 happens. And now you're like, is this like a temporary slump or is this like a trend? And I've got like a lot of emotional stock invested in the show. And that's where you see fandom split into two factions. You got those that are okay with some risk, which is like crap episodes, because, you know, we know from Candace that she wasn't filming very much for 4, 5, and 6. We know that already, but we believe the overall stock will bounce back, and 7, 8, 9 will be Iris heavy, and then we'll be good, and go into the back half. It's supposed to be a lot of Barry and Iris, so that's fine. I'm going to ride through the slump. And then you have those that are extremely risk-averse, that are ready to, like, dump all their stock now and burn down the building, because this is not the ride they signed up to take. You know, just her not having any kind of scenes, you have people yelling at her, and instead of understanding that how she might feel or even asking her if she's okay. For me, I'm probably not as risk averse as some people are, but it is kind of tiresome having to wait week after week to, you know, get a possibility of seeing a glimpse of something going on in Iris's life. Like, this is not a Netflix show. I can't binge it and skip crap episodes to get to what I want to get to. And so having to wait for these crumbs is kind of starting to wear on me. I feel like in the beginning we knew she wasn't filming much, obviously, but, you know, I guess in my mind I was thinking maybe she only films for one or like 2, 3 days, but if all of her shots are like interior shots, maybe she can get like a decent, you know, if not 10 minutes, a solid 8-minute story out of those 2, 3 days worth of work. But in the final product, I'm not really seeing that so much. So it's kind of like, you know, And it's not, I feel like the thing that's missing right now from her is the desperation element. Like, I don't necessarily need her to be with Barry every week or crying every week, about Barry, but I would like to see her become a little bit more desperate, or at least a little bit more aware of the time she has left with Barry the closer we get to Crisis. Because, like, she tells Ralph in one of their scenes that there's 6 weeks left, and it's like, okay, you know there's 6 weeks left, so why are you, you know, comforting Ralph when you should be thinking kind of like all the hours of, like, there's only 6 weeks left for me to get ready for this crisis. Because it's not just the team that needs to get ready, she has to get ready as well. So, like, rather than have her prop up and help an unappreciative Ralph, I would rather have them get more, like, stories of, like, even if it's only like a scene, like of Iris sending Camilla and Allegra out on assignments, pushing them to get more stories. Maybe they don't understand why. She's like, what is the rush? Why are we pushing so fast on doing this? And she's like, no, we need stories now. Like that kind of desperation, because she's trying to build up her paper to be big enough in order to take on the responsibility of reporting Crisis and writing Barry's legacy. I would like to see that, because I think that would show, even if it's not directly, if her and Barry don't spend any time in the episode, that shows that it's still on her mind. Like, if we're going to have to avoid her feelings directly, I would like for that to leak out in other places. Like, I know they're holding it all for 7, 8, and 9, because those are her, like, episodes to shine, because they're the most emotional points before Crisis. But I would, even if she's trying to hold it in, I would like to see it spill out in other places. And the other thing is, like, if Ralph didn't want to follow up in the lead, I would want to see, like, Iris obsessing over it, because she's trying to, it's something else to solve, something to keep her occupied. So not just her going to Ralph, but her, like, doing research and going on the lead by herself or doing something just so she can be doing something. And I also feel like they did this whole Ralph is dismissive to Iris bit twice. And then Joe walks in and Ralph is immediately, like, opens up and sings like a canary and pours out all of his feelings without very little prodding or effort. And it's just like, what was the reason for that? You know, to get Joe to a place of being emotional, because I feel like he didn't need that scene to do that. He already had a scene earlier with Barry that could have clearly drawn that conclusion from his scene in the beginning to a scene in the end. So I feel like it does a disservice to Iris, because yes, she sent Joe, but they could have had that scene be between Iris and Ralph, which would have resulted or should have resulted in Ralph apologizing then and not as a one-liner to Iris later. Like, oh, I apologize. I was a jerk. Okay. And then he leaves, you know? And then, so that kind of thing, the apology was great, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't make me feel better about the whole situation, to be honest. And then with Frost, I feel like without the context and the vocal fry, I cannot tell Frost and Caitlin apart now, because the writers don't really give her a consistent personality, and Danielle doesn't really ad-lib enough or do anything extra enough to give Frost a personality that makes up for the writer's lack of creativity. So, like, I swear there were a couple times in this episode where I was like, okay, this is just Caitlin in a Party City wig. Like, this is Caitlin, and she just has, like, white hair. Is that's how, like, they played her. They just don't, they're not really consistent in what her personality is. And her personality is different from Caitlin's. And I would like for them to keep that consistent. And it just feels like they forget which character that they're writing for. And so it just comes out as if Caitlin and Frost have already merged into one person. And we're just not going to see any kind of reason beyond that or why. Yeah. And then when the writers actually do remember that they're writing for Frost and that Frost has an edgier personality, and when Danielle remembers that she's supposed to have an edgier personality for Frost, it's like cringy kind of one-liners. Like, she did have like one good line in that Cisco scene, but she also had a couple of cringy ones. And then Danielle has like the whole crazy hand over, you know, exaggerating. And that's to show Killer Frost's personality more. But, like, just because you drop the killer from her name doesn't mean Frost should have lost all of her bite. And I feel like she's lost a lot of her bite just because the writers just don't really know what that personality is. Cecile, did we need her? I guess for Tati, that little emotional hand grab was good. But, you know.
The condescension. I feel like,
did we need her? No. Did Danielle collect her 30-second paycheck anyway? Yes, she did. So, you know, whatever. No Halloween costumes. I'm not as bummed out about this in the sense that I still think you can do a Halloween themed / thriller episode without the costumes. However, we all know, including Eric, that when Candace brought up Halloween and wanted to do a Halloween episode, our characters in fun costumes is what the audience wanted to see. So I don't know why they played themselves like that and had nobody dress up in costumes and just thought like Halloween pumpkins and, you know, some spooky decorations was going to cut it. That was not going to cut it. Yeah, and then next week I'm looking forward to knowing Wes Allen or having a romantic getaway sex that I won't get to see because it's probably off screen. So, you know, there you go.
Oh, God.
I feel like every season this is around the time where episodes start to get a little inconsistent in terms of, like, maintaining what the first couple of episodes brought us in terms of like strength of storytelling and acting and emotional scenes and whatever. And this scene was, this episode at least was like very emotional in terms of like believability of character relationships and how they're being impacted. I will say that I will take the hit this week and say I'm the person who believes it'll all pay off eventually, but I also have an advantage this season in that I can watch without being online at the time, so my investment will hopefully pay off in the long run. Anyway, I feel like the season on the whole in general has reignited my overall love for the show and that the story has been solid for the most part. Having said that, my initial thought of the previous episodes was that they were doing a great job of splitting up the characters, and I liked Iris' subplot in episode 3 too, but I can't say I liked it much here because the scene with Ralph and Joe should have definitely been Iris and Ralph. For one, he goes on about not having anything to live for, having like a what's the point attitude, but Iris almost died in season 3 and is about to lose Barry now, so it boggles my mind that the writers didn't write in an emotional scene between them here and have Ralph ask how she's been taking it, because I feel like that would have worked a lot better. So they're already good friends and he hangs out with Iris more than Joe, so like why not mind right. the hell out of that emotionally. And it was like right there. She was giving him a case. They could have either tried to investigate together. They could have worked on it together. There could have been a moment. I feel like if there had been that emotional moment, people wouldn't have been as angry because at least there would have been some sort of payoff to it. And it would just, it would have just been another good character interaction for Iris outside of Barry. And we would have gotten to see her talking a bit more about what's going on. Like, I don't need to see Barry and Iris talking about his death each week because it happened every week in season 3 and it did get tiring. But Iris and Ralph is different here and would have made the apology from him that much more meaningful. Plus, like, we sort of had his be open to love and finding Sue storyline last week. So I don't feel like we need to be hit over the head with the fact that Sue is coming. Like, if we didn't get it before, we get it now. Sue's coming. They're going to be in a relationship. They're going right. to get married. We understand. You know, I get that the show's not subtle, but I don't think they need to hit us over the head.
Consistent consistency in his Ralph on his way to finding Sue storyline than Iris is Central City Citizen.
Yeah,
like I feel like I could, if there was one episode where he did not think about Sue, I would be okay, and he would be okay as well. So,
yeah. I mean, my investment comes in the fact that like Crisis will probably make the Citizen very popular, and that will hopefully go into the second part of the season. But I know that everyone's like super impatient. But I just, for this episode, I think where season 3 went too hard on the Iris is dying week to week and West Island's conversations about it every single week all the time, and season 6 isn't really doing enough of that so far, so those like two extremes. So I'm really hoping episodes 7, 8, and 9 bring all the feelings and the emotions and the acting TM, so I can feel like my investment in patience has paid off.
You're being very generous.
I am, but I know that she did film a lot for it, for both of those episodes, so there we go. That's all I have is my hope.
And my hope is that, because they teased that 6B was like really Barry and Iris, things get really intense for them, and the whole, well, I guess that's our prediction, that she is involved in investigating Black Hole, but mm-hmm. they'd better pay off in one way or another.
Yeah.
As for my, you know, joyless sparks, I constantly have to like weigh what my objective view of the show minus Iris is with what my particularly biased Iris feelings are, and it's annoying because the show so often fails to do for her what it should, even when it's delivering a storyline that I would otherwise enjoy. So there's a lot of stuff in this episode that I would normally just be like, yes, that was great. And then I could just, like, happily enjoy if Iris got what I thought she should get. But then since she doesn't, I'm like, this episode is garbage! Even though, like I said, there's other things that I really liked. So, that being said, one thing I definitely did not like was the near-total lack of women in this week's episode. Yeah. Like, Rachel Rosso and Sue Dearborn haunted some dude's dreams. Iris held Ralph's hand while Cecile held Joe's hand. And Frost had her best / only good fight scene ever. But that's about it. Like, on the girl power front.
And she held Cisco's hand pretty much a couple times.
She did hold Cisco's hand too. So that was it. Like, so that already puts the episode in, like, you know, the bottom of the barrel for me. Now, there were some minor annoyances throughout that I can't even be bothered to bring up. But one thing that did kind of, like, not annoy, but bore me, is how Ramsay's storyline seems to kind of be stalling out. Like, the flashbacks of his mom were pointless to me. They didn't tell me anything I didn't already know about him, that he's told us 100 times since the first time that we met him. And Barry's desperation to save him, like, I liked how it paralleled his selflessness with Ramsay's selfishness, but given how selfish and useless we know that Ramsay already is and have known from the first episode, again, it kind of feels like, well, let's hurry up and get to the part where Barry figures that out, you know? So maybe if it hadn't been so obvious to us already that Ramsay is loopy and murdering people, would have been better. I already, you know, had previously said that Sisko was the only one who made sense to me, but I'll just add that I didn't really get how the serum was actually going to make Barry survive crisis. Like, were they saying, like, in this possibility, you'll take the serum right before you do whatever makes you disintegrate, and then you won't disintegrate? Like, was that what they were going to do?
I guess so.
How detailed was their knowledge of what happens in crisis that they're like, this serum is definitely, well, they being Sisko, this serum is what's going to save Barry. And
I also thought it was, like, weird that Barry is like, let's come up with a medical solution when a medical expert is deep in the recesses of Frost Mind somewhere. But Sisko, mechanical right. engineer, I'm pretty sure you can do it.
Yes. Like, and also, I don't know, the fact that Sisko cured, quote-unquote, metahumans, but can't cure cancer, whatever. Again, just things that are lies. So anyway,
well, I like the little nod to the whole Earth X Dominator world or whatever it was that mm-hmm. where they got the cure. That was
oh. Well, there you go.
That's why he can't cure cancer. He didn't have the cure to cancer.
Okay, so now, of course, the big thing, the thing that casts the pallor, the shadow over the episode for me, Iris out here suppressing her feelings about Barry's death. And we know that she's suppressing them because of that comment that Roth made about not spending time with him. And that she clearly physically, you know, with her face responded or, you know, reacted but didn't respond. Now, that's fine for her to do because it is in her character to suppress her emotions until she just can't anymore and she explodes. She's done that since the beginning of time. Do I necessarily like that they gave her that trait? Not really, but it is her trait. So that's realistic. What is not realistic to me and what I cannot stand is that it has been 2 years for Ralph, it has been 6 years for the majority of everyone else, and then it has been her entire life for Barry and Joe, right? That is how long all these people have known her. And in all of that time of knowing her, no one thinks, like, hey, you know what? We should prod Iris to get her to open up and to get her to be honest about her feelings and to make sure she's not bottling it up. You know, she seems like she's doing well, but we know she's not doing well because we have known her for long enough now to know that something's wrong. No one thinks to do that. No one asks her how she's doing. No one even talks to each other about how she might be doing and that they just haven't talked to her because they know that it will not go well. I just don't get it. I just don't get it. Like, we literally saw them do that with Sisko and Ralph in this episode. And Sisko and Ralph have that issue to a much smaller extent than Iris does. And Joe, you know, has the breakdown in front of his son-in-law, Barry, but doesn't even think to have a conversation with his daughter, Iris, about the fact that they are both going to lose Barry. And yes, you know, we can wait and see. And I am positive. I am 99.8% positive that a future episode will have Iris break down, will have Iris be comforted, will give Iris more, you know, screen time for her business, for her newspaper, etc. But this is us talking about single episodes, right? And in this single episode, I think they did a very poor job of showcasing Iris's reaction, even in the most minor detail, right? Like, yes, Candace wiped her tears in the opening sequence when they were talking about how Barry's going to die. And that's great. And then she reacted when Ross said the thing. And that's great. But that's Candace. That's not the writing actually doing anything for her. So, aside from that, Frost comes in and asks Iris how Ralph is doing when Ralph walks away, and doesn't ask Iris how Iris is doing. Why? Why? Why do we care how Ralph is doing?
Oh, yeah, that scene was so unnecessary with her walking and asking. It was like, why are you here?
Exactly. Why are you even in this scene? Okay. Now, like I said, I love the Barry and Joe scene, but those two lines did indeed rub me the wrong way. And I totally get, like, the whole explanation. Like, I know that Joe raised Barry to become the man he is today. And, in fact, he raised Iris to become the woman she is today, and that's why they are kind of the same in the way that they are selfless and heroic and brave and reckless, etc. So I don't need that to be defended to me. But I don't understand why they specifically had to point out, have it pointed out, for Barry to say that he is more grateful for Joe than Iris. Like, why can't he just say, I am so grateful to you, Joe. You made me a hero before I ever became the Flash. Why did you need to say before Iris, before the team? Because A, again, it's just pointing out Iris only to in the lesser section, even though I know she's not meant to be lesser, but in this episode, she feels lesser. And B, putting her with the team in both instances, I'm so grateful for Iris, so grateful for the team, but I'm more grateful for you, makes it sound like Iris and the team are equal. And then there's Joe on a separate level. And there's right. no circumstance in which that is acceptable or true. It would definitely be, I'm so grateful to the team, but I'm so much more grateful to you and Iris. Without you, Joe. And then he'd be like, before I fell in love with Iris, you were already an example of what awesome fatherhood is like, etc. You know, something that separates her from team. Because right now it's kind of like team and Iris, then Joe. And I know, again, this is just two lines, doesn't matter. But since I had nothing else to focus on, because Iris wasn't doing shit, I could focus on that. Okay. And predictions.
That Barry will say that Iris is the most important person to him, so everyone will rest.
Thank you. Because I know, in my heart of hearts, that both Barry and Joe would push each other off a cliff if it meant saving Iris. Okay? But that this episode did not show me that. So
I love that. Yeah, that's true.
Do you have a prediction, Jessica?
Well, I mean, I already know that, like, I don't have any high hopes of seeing Barry and Iris actually on vacation in the next episode. And I'm just, I think I've basically said mine that in the back half that, you know, we think that Black Hole is going to come out. And then that's really going to be where Iris and Barry's storylines come into play. I don't really have much. Sue will finally come and then Ralph can just shut the fuck up about where is Sue.
Oh, yeah. Sue needs to be Iris's best friend as well as Ralph's future wife, because Iris doesn't have a best friend right now and she deserves one.
But you know yeah. what I'm concerned about in general? This is not a prediction, just a general concern, is that this show just has too many characters. And if they're going to introduce Sue and she's going to be on the show, then that means she's also going to get screen time and there's just too many fucking people.
Hopefully she'll join Iris's like news reporting yeah. staff.
And so like, that will be acceptable level. To me. Yes. Yeah.
But then we also have Chester P. Runk, who is waking up sometime soon. I saw his name come up in an episode. I think it was episode 6 that Cecile and has a storyline with Chester. I'm like, what are you going to do with him now? So yeah, it is quite crowded over on The Flash.
My prediction is that Barry will make sure that everyone from Ralph to the napping Jenna is good with his death. And then he will finally walk in on Iris bawling one morning and he'll be like, oh, babe, I had no idea you were suffering. You've always been so strong. And then we will get our storyline. Okay. Black Lightning time. The Book of Occupation, Chapter 4, Lynn's Ouroboros. Jefferson yells at Anissa and turns Grace into a child before repenting and actually helping his Harriet Tubmanovich daughter. Lynn tweaks out, but it's for the greater good. But actually, wait, it's for the even greater evil of Agent O'Dell. Meanwhile, Jennifer finds her confidence in peacekeepers shaken. Khalil preaches to everyone he murders, and James Remar gets paid for the split-second appearance of Gandhi's face. The episode was written by Adam Giandrone and directed by Mary Lou Belli. What sparked joy?
Well, I had jumped off the ship last week. But this week they roped me back in, and I'm talking about Thunder Grace. The fact that Grace is concerned what? With how Anissa perceives her is a legit concern. Like, you know, she keeps, I don't know why, was it that she's like off meds or something like that, that she just keeps shape-shifting at different intervals during the day or whatever. But I really liked Anissa's response. I thought it was very thoughtful, and she was very confident saying like, that's it, I want to be with you however you are. And it's actually like what would have been nice to see with Brainy and Nia, to be honest, because mm-hmm. that is like along the same something similar. So I love that aspect, and I really felt like they're finally giving this ship something more concrete than what's been given before in the past. Lynn finally getting a win, saving a metahuman after two seasons of saving no one. Well, thank God for that. Yes, congratulations, Lynn. Khalil's outfit, I don't know. It just, there was something about it that was very,
for you.
Very, very beautiful. And I don't know, because, like, I mean, yes, this version of him is clearly evil or whatever, but I don't know. Jordan Calloway is killing it. So good on you, Jordan.
He's killing it.
What else did I like? Generally speaking, I like that Henderson is helping. He helped Black Lightning and Blackbird, you know, break everybody out of the police station and then send them over to the other side. And that finally got Jefferson and Anissa to actually work together after their big blowout fight. For the first time ever, I think Gambi mentioned an ex-wife. So that took me by surprise. I don't know if that's necessarily a like, but I was like, huh, Gambi did have a life before he came to Freeland or whatever. So that was interesting. And I do like how generally his face changer is working for them in terms of like planning and being able to get around the city in terms of, you know, helping people. So Jefferson's reactions to Freeland and what's been happening in Freeland, because he's been gone for so long, like the whole occupation, and seeing all of this in front of him and still like wanting to do something for his students and whatnot was really good. I'm on board with the ASA being the root of all evil. I don't like Odell, though, but I think that they're really making it clear that it isn't Markovia who is the evil in the case of, like, ASA being way more evil than them, and, like, how they're tricking the people into thinking, like, Jennifer. They're tricking Jennifer into thinking that this is all well and good because they're just protecting the people. So I like the fact that was argued in terms of, like, how police state, they're always going to be like, but we're doing it for you. We're trying to protect you. And her classmates are like, no, they're not. We can't do anything. We don't have freedom of speech. Their internet is blocked. They get arrested for dumb shit. They have metahuman sensors and they're sending everybody to jail. So I like that was presented in a way where, like, you have Jennifer, who is a protagonist, who is also thinking these thoughts, because if someone's feeding them to you, you're going to start thinking those things too, because you think, you know, these people are here to help and they protected her and her family so far. So, like, why would they be the bad guys or whatever? So I liked all of that. I like that Jamila continues to, like, sneak into all of the places and getting her little news stories. She's very resourceful. But this will be prediction. Yeah, I think that was about it.
I think that this was another solid episode, starting with Thunder Grace, since I haven't really been a fan of it as of late. I agree with Paulina that I thought Anissa's conversation with Grace this episode in the bedroom was a much better and much more believable love declaration than the previous week. It felt more earned here than it did last week. So I thought that was good. I also am enjoying Jordan Calloway enjoying being Khalil as this kind of, like, super assassin kind of thing. I like how he was, like, talking to those two guys trying to find out who was, well, he was making his way to Sisnil, basically, to get all of the stolen merchandise back for Odell. And he was talking to the two guys about how the people will do anything to get rid of pain and to take pain away. And he's like, lucky for y'all, that's why they call me Painkiller. And so, like, he had, like, a lot of, like, really, really good lines. Like, he had a lot of really good writing, and I think he played it off really well. And I just, in general, enjoyed, even though he's, like, psychopath, basically, like, an unfeeling, he is what Lena Lena's gonna turn the world into on Supergirl. But he plays it really well, and so I just enjoy his scenes in general. And Khalil doesn't seem as much of a time suck this season as he did last season. Who knew all he had to do was turn into a psychopath, but, you know, whatever. The whole, like, welcome to the occupation and Jefferson trying to, like, reacclimate to Freeland, which was totally changed and totally different from when he first went into the pit. Like, everything is different now. And
you know, you've got checkpoints and resistance and like they're shooting and everything. And Jeff is like freaking out. And contrastly, Jin is like, chill, Dad. Like, this is the new normal, and how uncomfortable that makes him living in this kind of new war zone like world. So I thought that kind of like seeing this newly through the eyes of Jefferson was really good. I still think I'm on board with the whole ASA as the general evil in this season. Not necessarily even Markovia. Like, we haven't even dipped into Markovia actually being a threat. It's more your home. The home team is might be just as or even more evil than the person they're trying to protect you from, and how that's playing out between Odell's like odd relationship with Jennifer, and how he's kind of like, again, like he's separated them into different corners. He's separated Lynn from Jeff by getting her hooked on Green Light and giving her this cause to fight for, because he knows that she is a bleeding heart for saving people and helping people, and that she would do anything. And then you have his relationship with Jen, and how that kind of came from him isolating her from her parents. And now he's the only one giving her, you know, a little bit of access. You want to know with Markovians? I will send you a link. It's an encrypted link. I'll send you a link. I'll send you a voicemail of your parents. And now he's like, I'll give you a suit and show you what you can really do. I did like that the final scene of her like going up into space, and I don't know how she breathed up there, but I like seeing her up there, and like the whole visual effects of that I thought were really nice. I think that's most of my likes. I think that's good. You can go, Tati.
A lot of likes. I liked it. I like your likes.
Thanks.
Okay. I think that Odell is turning into a far superior villain than Tobias was, although I really don't like Odell. I like Tobias more, but he's like a master chess player, so that's interesting to watch. Also, I very much have enjoyed Khalil and his psychopathic, you know, and yet very calm method of murder since, you know, post mother time. Not that.
I did forget one like. The break-in at the police precinct.
Oh, yeah.
In the dark. And Henderson was just like, don't move. Just let her take out all these people. And yeah. I like that fight sequence. So that was cool.
Yeah, Henderson is, you know, continuing to do his very best. And I appreciate him for everything that he tries to do. So, also, I, you know, watching Lynn nearly destroy herself in order to save the menace was frustrating and painful. But the moment when she wound up saving that old dude who has been married for 32 years or whatever was awesome. And I totally cheered. I was like, oh my God, it worked. Thank you, baby Jesus. So, and it's like, payoff. Also glad that, you know, we're getting to see more of Jennifer's classmates and that they were, like, having, like, a spirited debate about what is real and what is not, and what is, you know, keeping the peace and what is not. So hopefully they will be useful in fighting her ASA indoctrination. I loved how Anissa's blackboard stuff played out. I love that she's able to defy Odell's control, like, right under his nose, that she got out several suspected metas safely, that Jefferson was able to assist her in that endeavor, that he flattered Odell's wishes in a way that even Odell couldn't shut down for now. Like, he knew what had happened, and he, like, gave his dumbass warning, but he couldn't really do anything about it right now. So that was great. Also, I did love Anissa's speech to Grace. It was what Nia's speech to Brainy should have been, considering that Grace's situation is much more difficult to handle than Brainy's. And I also liked that she, you know, at the same time that she was like, obviously this body is my favorite one. I don't want that. It's not like I'm like,
I don't like the old guy or the small child.
Not into the tiger, not into the small child, but I love all of you and I'm gonna be here for that. So I really like that. So yeah, what did not spark joy?
Didn't like that we kind of skipped over a big moment for Thunder Grace, though, like in terms of Anissa revealing her powers to Grace and having to find out about it through her and Jefferson's fight. That was sad times. Speaking of Jefferson, I get that he's overprotective, but I think he was taking out his frustrations on Anissa and Lynn throughout the episode was just not it for me. Like, he went way too hard with Anissa being reckless as a blackbird, even though she was trying to do the right thing. And then with Lynn, like the synopsis from last week said that she and Jefferson were having tension, but it really showed up in this episode. So last week was wrong. And I feel like we know why Lynn was doing what she was doing and why she was acting the way she was acting. I think that Jefferson just needed, like, he's frustrated with the whole situation in Freeland, so he's just taking it out on his family. But I feel like I wanted him to step back and realize what was really going on with his wife, but I'm sure we'll see that later on. And Lynn, I was really happy that she saved the metahuman. I'm not really happy that the ASA and Odell convinced her to start taking the green light drug so that she could continuously work 24/7, because she looks like she's about to collapse. And I'm very concerned, and I don't like it. And I don't like this whole addiction storyline and where it's going. So they can keep it. What else? Oh, I get where Jennifer's coming from, and China Ann McClain is so good at crying, but I really...
It was not that emotional, that video.
Yeah, well, my thing is this, is like, she's still young, yes, but she's also very smart, and I would have liked her to realize that Odell, or at least question Odell and what he was doing, because he sent her a video through a private link. That video was probably doctored. Like, come on, you know, with all the stuff happening and the lockdown and the occupation, it's a little bit ridiculous knowing that he sort of took her family hostage in a way, and she's just not questioning him at any point, except like making snarky comments at him. But she's like believing him and falling into his trap, which is exactly what he wants. But I want her to be like, hopefully come to the conclusion that he is no good. Other things I did not like. I think those are like the biggest things, like those just gaps in people's behaviors and not questioning the overall stuff. I think the episode was very strong overall, though.
Yeah. So basically, when I was watching this episode and I saw like Lynn creating like her green light whatever, I'm like, okay, so she created like green light Adderall, like, is that what we're doing? It's cool. I mean, like, regular Adderall probably would have worked just as fine, but I guess it's not like totally her fault, since Odell has been secretly hypnotizing her for weeks to take green light. So that's one thing that kind of makes, I don't know if it makes it better, because she's still now addicted to addictive substance. But for most of the episode, we didn't know that that's what was happening. So I just spent a lot of it frowning over what seems to be a pattern in Lynn's like substance abuse behaviors that don't really get addressed on the show. And I remember asking Christine Adams this at SDCC, because I was like, you know, last season when she had like the horrible press parent teachers or parents conference about the green light babies, and then Jennifer left, like she had this whole kind of sequence where it was her and a bottle was her best friend, like, you know, all of that kind of thing. And it kind of went under the rug, like, yes, she was drinking a lot. And then it kind of didn't disappear, didn't come back as like an actual storyline. So I asked her, like, you know, was that supposed to be a storyline or not? And I can't remember. I think she liked the idea of delving into that, but and I don't know, she obviously would have known at that point that they're doing this green light thing. But again, it's like another kind of deep dive into something that I don't necessarily know that they will deal with on the show. And I guess, like, depending on when Odell bugged their house, it's possible he knew of Lynn's first trip down to the bottom of a bottle, and he's abusing that and the virus situation, because he knows that Lynn, again, will do anything to help people. And that's why he came up with this idea for green light. I don't know if that will be explained or anything will happen because of that. I don't know what will happen to Lynn because of this. So that's concerning. I don't like what this means for her or her relationship with Jefferson, because the whole them not talking and him trying to be on the same page, but then her spending all her time at the ASA and them not talking is directly related to Odell hypnotizing her and, you know, getting her to drug herself and be chained to his needs and what he wants for those Greenlight kids. Also, that lady playing Major, that bitch can go somewhere. Don't like her at all. She's, like, unnecessarily aggressive, and yeah, she can go. Also, now I feel kind of differently about you guys, about Thunder Grace, because now that I've given Thunder Grace a compliment in the like section, I've come to the complaint part of my compliment sandwich, and that it feels like to me, like, yeah, it was, they had like a really good conversation, but it just feels like Anissa is Grace's babysitter, and it doesn't really help that Grace turns into like a literal child this episode. But just like when I look at this relationship and Anissa is basically taking care of Grace, and then I compare that to her brief relationship with Jamila, it just feels like Anissa is burdened with taking care of Grace rather than them being like strong together or like on equal ground. And I guess, I mean, Grace brought it up that she feels like a burden, and she's, Anissa's like, oh no, you're not a burden, but actually, like, she kind of is. But I mean, there's this kind of romanticizing of it, and I just feel like, but does this really need to be Anissa's problem? Like, it's great that she wants to, she sees Grace's faults, and is still open to pursuing a relationship with her, but I guess, like, I guess I'm just not even optimistic either, basically, with Thunder Grace as a whole, with how they've been written, that just makes me less sympathetic to the whole situation. And then again, like May said, you have Anissa telling Grace that she's Blackbird Thunder off screen. So, I mean, because that was another thing. I was like, well, you know, Anissa knows all this about Grace, but does Grace know about Anissa? And apparently she does, but we just never saw it on screen. But it just feels like really, really imbalanced. And I feel like Anissa has enough going on that this is kind of dragging her story down a little bit. I would like to, we still don't even understand or know enough about Grace to understand why she hasn't started to see her powers as compared to a burden, or why she has these powers in the first place. So that there's still like all of these holes. And the whole relationship at the moment feels like a nice but really thick wool blanket that could just smother you. So that's where I am. There's no additional compliment because this is an open face sandwich. There's no compliment on the end of it. But that's kind of how I'm feeling at the moment about them.
Okay. I saw people were arguing with, or, you know, conversing with the writer of the episode about the fact that Grace had to find out off screen, and it seemed like they literally didn't realize that it hadn't happened on screen, or like they just had imagined how it happened and then just like never wrote it down. I don't know, but either way, it is very much like they don't put enough effort into this relationship. It doesn't make sense. Anissa is one of the three biggest characters on the show, right? So there's no reason why her ship should not get, especially because this is a show that kind of equally doles out screen time for Jefferson, Anissa, and Jefferson. Jennifer. I said that. Jennifer, Anissa, Jefferson. That was a J sandwich. But anyway, so it doesn't make sense that they would have it happen off screen. So I agree that I'm still a little bit on shaky ground with the Anissa and Grace relationship. Like, I root for them. I want them to be together. I want them to be happy. But the way that they're doing it is a little bit shaky. And it's kind of the opposite problem of the Nia and Brainy situation, where... the way you described it, it's like the opposite. Like, the Supergirl wants us to believe that this is all Brainy's issue, and that Nia is like putting up with it, right? And that Brainy needs to change in order for Nia to have less to put up with. But here it's like this is all like Anissa's taken that on, and Grace is the one that's trying to keep her from it. And Anissa's like, bring it all on, you know, it's putting it all on Anissa, even though she's very willing to do it. But like, Grace's issue is something that should indeed be controlled. She should not be eating people as a tiger. We definitely want to manage that. So yeah, it's like the opposite. Anyway, the fact that Odell was subliminally brainwashing Lynn into taking the green light was upsetting to me in a different way than her having taken it in the first place was. Because I also thought that the show was going to finally tackle Lynn's substance abuse problems when the episode started. Like, I thought it was going to be like, I won, but at what cost, right? She's like... Mm-hmm. She wiles herself away in order to save other people, but she's falling into these dangerous habits, these dangerous and addictive habits. But instead, no, it's just making her a further pawn in Odell's game, that she doesn't really have her own agency, which again is a point in favor of him being Black Lightning's best villain yet, but it makes the character situations that I'm watching unfold on my screen less enjoyable, because it feels like I'm just playing the world's longest game of chess, in which my opponent is so good, and they keep stealing all my pieces, and I don't even notice, because I don't know how to play chess, and I don't know how many pieces I had to start with. So, that is my issue with it, which is also the same thing I have with, you know, Jennifer, right? Jennifer being manipulated by Odell, Jennifer being, like, ASA's child soldier. I'm like, please, it's gonna happen. Let's just meet, let's just see Khalil, let's see what happened, and wake up! So, there you go. Speaking of, predictions.
Yes, I have one of Jennifer's classmates is an ASA spy or something, because she was staring way too long at the new kid in two separate scenes. Like when he passed by.
She liked him though, right?
You think so?
Yeah, she had like a crush on him, and she was like, and she was mad that Jennifer got to be tour guide because she was trying to get with him. So I just thought it was a crush, but that's interesting.
Oh. So, because I don't know her, so I was like, I'm assuming the worst.
She's not Keisha,
I mean, that's what I thought at first, actually. Like, at first, I was like, oh, she has a crush, and she's mad that Jennifer got to do the thing. But then when he just walked off by himself, she was looking at him real weird. Mm-hmm. I was like, what's going on there?
The first time she did it, he was passing by all the kids getting checked in the meta line, and he was like, no, I already have my ID. And she looked at him like she knew he didn't or something. I don't know. It was weird.
I think he might be a meta. And that's why he dodged the line.
I think exactly. He was definitely.
What if he's like related to Wayne Brady or how Wayne Brady?
Interesting.
That could also be a reason why he has.
I totally forgot about Wayne Brady.
Yes. Wayne Brady is coming.
Wayne Brady is coming. Okay. Any other predictions?
Mm-mm.
All right. So then, our last and most certainly least. Sorry, just kidding. Not kidding. Titans. In the aftermath. Oh, sorry. The episode was called Atonement. In the aftermath of Disc's confession, the OG Titans act like the hypocrites they are and peace out. Corey has to go burn her ex-boyfriend alive because her sister is talking through him, and Gar is left alone to read Tale of Two Cities to Connor until the latter beats up all the cops in town. Hank and Don return to Wyoming and realize they're assholes. Rachel gets in a car with Donna and then gets out of the car using her dark powers. Dick apologizes to Adeline and then tries to fly to Greenland and then gets himself arrested. I don't know who wrote this episode, and I don't care. So, what sparked joy?
I will say that the montage of Gar doing absolutely nothing outsold every other OG Titan scene on this show. I like that he finally got some, like, a lot of screen time in this episode. And just in general, like, his hopefulness and his optimistic personality. I like that he started out on day one or day alpha, like, yes, Gar's on the case. We're gonna, you know, take care of Connor. We're gonna get the Titans back together. It's day one, success. And, you know, he's, like, all pumped up. And then it's not even, like, week two. It's, like, day two. And he's just like, oh, my God, this is so boring. Come back, please. Somebody help me, you know. And, like, just seeing him do stuff around the house, train, and try and, like, keep it together. Was just really nice to see more of him. And then I really enjoyed when Connor actually did wake up, and he's like, surprised, like, hi! And Gar turns around, he's just, like, stark naked. He's like, okay, first things first, let's get some clothes. But I liked Gar being, like, the welcome committee for Connor and explaining about the Titans and who the Titans are supposed to be, and that they're supposed to be heroes, and how he has all these big plans of how they're going to be so great when all the guys come back. As soon as they know that Connor is awake, that everyone's going to come back and everyone's going to not be mad anymore. And how his version of training Connor to be a hero was like video games. And as soon as like Connor beat like the biggest level, he's like, yes, you are ready for patrol. I like their dynamic. I like Connor being like, you know, not really sure what's going on, but happy to be here. I liked Corey's storyline and that she got screen time.
so with her and Fide, there's a couple things that I have like a lot of issues with on that story, but just in general, I still think her and Fide have a lot of really great chemistry, so it's nice to see them together on the road again to stop Blackfyre. It seems like finally getting some movement on that storyline, so that's always a plus. This is so weird coming from me in first season and not liking Hank at all, but he's probably like my favorite OG Titan right now next to Dick when he's not being Dick. Because he just, it feels like they just retconned him to make him more likable. Like even in the flashback scenes, he has been like the only thing that I ever liked about any of those scenes. And like this scene had him singing. And maybe it's just like Alan Richardson that I like a lot, and he made sense. The reason why, like, you don't go back to the place where you got a kid killed. I mean, that makes sense to me, Hank. So, but yeah. Yeah, that's it. I liked Hank.
A sad indictment of this episode.
This is where we've come. This is where we are right now.
I will say on the whole Dick's apology tour, I can't remember. Oh yeah, like watching it, Jericho is obviously still alive. I did like him going to like the whole, I liked the scene. I didn't know necessarily like Dick's motivations or whatever, but I liked how the scene played out of him trying to apologize to Adelaide, and she's like, well, you need to go talk to whoever's in the room, and it turns out to be what looks like Slade. But then they kind of get into it, and at one point, you know, it just seems like Slate was like, haha, I've won, I sentence you, like, he's like, I'm a judge, and I sentence you to be alone for the rest of your life. I'm like, this sounds kind of juvenile. And then when Dick was like, you didn't deserve Jericho, none of us deserve Jericho, that he was better than all of us. And you see Slade kind of like hesitate or pause, and then he like struggle a little bit, and that's when they decide to like break it off. It's like it did seem like, I guess, like they had planned this, and Jericho was going to have his big moment. So I guess it's predictions, but basically talking through Slade, and then there's that moment of hesitation, like maybe I shouldn't go through with all of this. And then, you know, mom and dad step in, and then it's over. But that little glimmer of Jericho still being in there, I liked that, how that scene played out. And that's probably it. That's probably the end of my likes. Okay, go.
That's also a prediction. So you think Jericho is inside Slade?
Yeah. And spoilers. Like Slade being in the house makes, and them all being in on this together. Oh, this is a like prediction. So I'm just going to shut up and wait till predictions. So go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I really like that scene too. I especially like Jericho's mom, whose name, do we know her name? What is her name?
Adeline. Let's find out.
Addie. Not taking Addie. Dick's apology and leaving him to stew in his guilt for it's a little Adeline's while longer. Name. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, she's like, I know you came here for me to forgive you, and I'm not going to give you my forgiveness because basically what you did was wrong, and I'm going to let you sit in your guilt for a little while longer because you're not getting that from me. That was a badass moment. Love that. I also like the montage of Gar, because Gar is the sweetest, cutest Titan, and he deserves more screen time. So I'm glad that we got to see a lot more of him, but I'm sad that we had to wait until all the other Titans were gone to see it. But I did like his little team up with Connor. And how he was like trying to teach him all this stuff, and it was cute. So I hope that relationship grows. I like that Fide was back. I thoroughly enjoy his scenes with Corey. I think they do have great chemistry. I completely agree with that. And I think that they give so much, like there's so much there in between the lines where it's not written in the script, but they just play off of each other so well. Like they're flirty and they've got so much going on. And it's just like a nice breath of fresh air in this very, very depressing show. And I really like the whole bar bar scene between them, even though it wasn't like Fide, but how Corey caught on to the fact that it was her sister, even though she didn't have to say it out loud, and she continued playing the game. That was a really good scene because you could tell like he was acting different, and I think he did a really good job differentiating between his character and Blackfyre. I think that was pretty much it.
It was an amazing episode. I loved Gargan screen time for sure. I loved him reading all these different classic novels to Connor. I was like, is there symbolism here? It was Tale of Two Cities, and then it was Frankenstein. Obviously, Frankenstein is symbolism. Tale of Two Cities, I don't know, two parents, I don't know, two dads. One is evil and one is good. And then he read the poem Hickory Dickory Dock, and I was like, Dick Corey canon, done. Because that's the only, this is the most, speaking of, that's the most Dick Corey we've had all season, when Gar said Hickory Dickory Dock, and when Corey was like, oh, I would stay, but I have to go burn my ex-boyfriend alive. So I'll see you later. So that was nice. Nice that she would stay otherwise. And I really liked Connor and Gar's dynamic. I was like having a really good time watching them. And it would have been nice if that had a better outcome. But but they were very sweet together. And I especially love Gar's optimism and the fact that he really does believe in the message of the Titans. He feels like the only one who does. At this point, the only one who puts it above the petty concerns or differences between the members. Anyway, I also liked the scene with Dick and Adeline. I liked that she wasn't having his apology. And I only like the scene that happened next with Slade if it is in fact Jericho inside Slade, because it was just so weird. It was like eerie and like menacing, but in a way that Slade is not, because he seemed like super like weak. I don't know, it was weird. Like, he had trouble standing. He was so, like, petty. Like, he was aggressively but petty, you know? Because, like, the Slade we've seen would just murder Dick, you know? But this one was like, my revenge is complete. Now, you don't have friends. Just like I don't have family, even though I'm here in my wife's home, clearly having a family. So, anyway. I thought that was really interesting. Also, I liked the fact, I don't know if I can credit the Titans writers with doing this on purpose, but I liked how easily the Elliot situation paralleled with the Jericho situation. Because for me, I'm like, what are y'all talking about? Y'all are so fucking mad. Yeah, that Dick brought this kid into your lives and then he got himself killed. His father killed him because he was protecting Dick. Like, Dick did that. In y'all's mind, even though y'all all agreed to bring this child in. And then meanwhile, Don and Hank had brought this child into their home, who then got murdered because of them, because of their lives, because of who they are. And then they just peaced out. They didn't even talk to the family. They didn't even do anything for his family. They didn't even give any explanations. And then they come waltzing back into that town, not thinking about that child, singing Ain't No Mountain High Enough. And they have to get a talking to from that sister. And I was like, hey, listen, what does this sound like? Dick? Does it sound like Dick? Of course, they didn't say that or acknowledge that. So I don't know if it was done on purpose on the writer's side. But if it was, kudos. And if it wasn't, what a great coincidence. Those are my likes.
I will say I did like two little things. I did like Rachel walking out on Donna. Like, she's like, I'm going to go with Donna.
That's right.
That's cool. And then, like, Donna started bitching. She's like, you know what? I'm getting out of this taxi. Yeah. I like how they're in, like, a traffic jam. But then when she gets out, there's, like, no traffic there. But,
right. Yeah. That's another point in the favor of what Dick, like, this is not just on Dick. The fact that Rachel was like, all y'all did that. All y'all lied.
Yes.
All y'all agreed and all y'all lied. So yes. I was like, all right, impact queen.
Thank you, Rachel. And then I also like the sister kind of like tearing into, like, they were like, but you did bad things, you did drugs, your boyfriend got him hooked on the first place. She's like, well, y'all tried to help him and then he died, so whose fault is that? Like, she threw it back in their face. I thought it was kind of funny. And deserved
indeed.
Yes.
So what did not spark joy?
The continuing self harm decisions that Dick made, and him trying to punish himself, basically. I agree with you on, like, him telling them what happened, and
the fact that Hank's first reaction is to punch him. I did not like that. Bad Hank. But all of them just being like, you told us he was dead when you got there. So how is it, again, Dick's fault that he died? If, like, y'all thought he was dead at first and y'all left him because of that, when y'all all agree that he should go and talk to his dad. And now you find out that he died saving Dick. And now you're still mad at Dick. For what reason? And I, again, like, goes back to Rachel with Donna in the car, and Donna's being like super bitchy about it. And he's like, and she's like, you know what? He didn't do it by himself. Y'all all made the decision to use this child in your petty revenge plot. And so it's not just on Dick that he's no longer, like, he's no longer, Jericho's no longer here. And I get Rachel and Jason, understandable why they wouldn't want, like, Rachel, that's her brother. Jason, he's already been through a lot of shit with the Titans, so it's cool that they left. Rachel, the fact that it's just that she wasn't told to begin with, and all the secrecy and lies, so I get that. But just, like, the OG Titans from the beginning, I saw, like, a tweet on Twitter, like, the only thing that they've done this season is sit in the kitchen and judge people. That's exactly how. That's the only thing that they've done. The fact that we had a side plot of Don and Hank, and that they're breaking up again, it's just the cycle of pain that is. It's painful to watch them on screen together. So I agree. Let's end the cycle of pain and just, like, take them out of the equation entirely. And Corey's storyline, it doesn't seem consistent, because last time that we learned about Tamaran, she didn't want to be in Tamaran, because, and we thought it was because some kind of, you know, oppressive classist system in Tamaran that she was trying to escape from. But then she doesn't want Blackfyre to be head of Tamaran, and she's like, how can this be? How can she take my crown? Like, Corey, you didn't want your crown, so who's supposed to have the crown if you don't want it? And then the fact that, I don't know if she thought that her court was just going to hold it down while she's on extended vacation in Earth until she decided to go back, or I don't really know what the plan was, because we didn't spend a lot of time in Corey's storyline. So now she wants to go back and save Tamaran, but what is she saving it from? And Blackfyre's beef just seems very kind of, it seems like their issues are very sisterly, we annoy each other issues, like, that any siblings would have. And so how that blows up into this entire war for planets, and why Blackfyre felt the need to, like, kill not only the court but also their parents in this struggle, it's not really been made clear. So I'm just kind of, you know, it's good to see that there's something that's happening in Corey's life. It's just, like, I don't really understand why it's such a serious situation, because they haven't really set it up that well. So, yeah. And then Dick's pity flight to Greenland. I mean, come on. How long is he supposed to punish himself for this? And the fact that he bought a ticket and then didn't get on the plane. He decided to get arrested. Like, what is his end game? Like, what is he planning to do? Yeah. Yeah.
There's just so much nonsense. So, nothing in this episode made a lot of sense. The OG Titans leaving because they're judging McJudgersons, or, you know, like that tweet said, standing around the kitchen looking disappointed or whatever the hell they're doing. When obviously they knew that they had something to do with it too. Like, Donna and Rachel, then they went off and they disappeared for the rest of the episode. I thought it was really dumb and pointless. We didn't see anything of what happened with Jason and Rose. Then Dick leaving Gar behind to fend for himself with a superpowered comatose boy sleeping in the back was nonsense. Like, these are adults and they're being so irresponsible. Call Bruce being his only instructions. Like, what kind of bullshit? And clearly he's not picking up. Bruce is not a dependable guy right now, so please do not call Bruce. Hank and Don not telling Ellis's sister about his death was really dumb, because that means they're extra hypocrites, but it only means that there's even more unnecessary drama in their relationship that we don't need. Like, if you're planning on breaking them up, I would just rather the writers do it sooner than later because it's just taking too long, and it's boring, and the whole thing is just boring and lame. Fide did not need to die just so Corey could talk to her sister. Like, I think he was strong enough to fight Blackfyre. They said that he was. Why couldn't he have saved himself? Or Corey could have saved him. So that's like a huge connection to Corey's life on Tamaran gone. And all we're left with is a sister rivalry that has no meat to it just yet. Like, we don't know anything about what's really going on there. We haven't seen the planet. We just gotten snippets of the controversy, but like you said, Jess, there's no consistency to the storyline. So it's just like, here, have some Corey, but then we're getting like the peas in a meal when we can have the whole plate of other things.
Terrible thing. Amazing metaphor.
We don't get the rice, we don't get the ground beef, we don't get any of that. We just get the peas, the little tidbits, the crumbs. And we don't want that at all because it's not making any sense. It's not shaping up to be what it could. And it's very frustrating because it's like a stop start constantly. Every other episode, we skip it. And this is the most significant screen time she's gotten in a few episodes now, which is just disappointing. And then Dick's mopey, I need to get far away and go to Greenland, whole subplot or whatever, was just hilarious. And then he decided to punish himself and get himself arrested. It was just so melodramatic. And while I did like that Gar got some screen time, I don't like that the rest of his storyline was spent trying to absolve Connor from feeling bad about stuff that I can't remember what he was talking about. But it was just trying to be like, no, everything will be okay. But you know, Gar was just abandoned by everyone, and I just wanted more from that storyline. And I also did expect Rose to show up at the Wilson's house because it's like she's not even a part of the family at all. So I would rather have had her appearance there to clue us into something, because so far there's no connection at all to this family, even though she's supposed to be Jericho's sister.
Yeah, I thought that would have been useful. We still don't know, like, If Adeline took her husband back, then what is she even mad at Dick for when her husband's the one that killed Jericho? because he did say it and she did not disagree, and yet her husband is in her house, so whatever. But aside from that, I don't like that Gar is now burdened with the fact that Connor went haywire under his care. That's another thing. That is on Dick for leaving Gar all alone. I don't like that Dick left Gar alone with the supposed intention of coming back and then decided he would go to Greenland, and then that either he decided he would get himself arrested or someone possessed him and got him arrested, it was so melodramatic that I thought that's what had to have happened. Like, there's no way that Dick just was like, I'm dropping this ticket, I'm dropping this bag, I'm taking this gun, arrest me.
Like, was Jericho at the airport and was like, no, Dick, you don't get to run away.
I don't know. Or Blackfyre. Like, Blackfyre was like, hey, why not, you know? Because I was like, okay, it's Jericho. But then the Blackfyre thing happened. First, I thought Jericho would possess Dick.
Yeah, there's a lot of possession going on in this episode.
And then the Blackfyre situation happened, and what's his face was killed, so I thought maybe she's possessing Dick. But speaking of, what's his face, Fade, I cannot believe they wasted that chemistry, they wasted that backstory, they wasted literally the only link we have, Tamaran, and had Corey have to burn him alive. Like, why? Why? Why couldn't Blackfyre have done something to him that Corey couldn't prevent, so that we see what a threat Blackfyre is? Because right now, her threat is, LOL, I burned your ship and I killed everyone that we don't know because we've never met them because we don't know anything about Tamaran. Like, this doesn't mean anything to me. Yeah, so like, the fact that Corey had to do it, and on such little provocation, like, she was posing no threat. She was literally like, maybe we will fight. Maybe we will take 10 episodes to Dragon Ball Z power ourselves up, and then we will battle. No, we will not. I will just burn you alive. So I was just like, okay, this is so stupid. In the way that... whatever. Moving on. Other storylines. Don and Hank, so stupid. I do expect them to be endgame or whatever. I'm sure that they're just like another obstacle they have to overcome, but I don't really care about them overcoming obstacles. I totally agree with Hank. They are toxic, and their dumb relationship should end, and they should just never be seen again. The world would be better without Hank and Don on our show. aside from that, just like, for example, I think that the way the world building on Titans is just so weak. Like, Donna is talking voice out loud about Dick having killed this kid or being responsible for this kid's death in this taxi. And then she says, in the same voice to the taxi driver, directions, right? And then Rachel does weird dark power thing in the car that clearly other people can see. And then we don't even cut to the taxi driver. Like, did the taxi driver see anything at all? Did he ever turn? Is it in the rearview mirror? Does he think that people are weird? Does he exist? Was Donna just talking to an empty space? We don't know. So that's that on that. Predictions?
Okay, so obviously Slade is back in the house, so that's how Rose got here. So we know that happened. I feel like Jericho is somewhere in the house, but for that conversation, they had him speak through Slade, so that, because they probably knew that Dick was on his way, because Dick does what Dick does, and that's what Dick would do. And so they set up this whole thing where Jericho could have his moment to give it to Dick, and then Dick says what he says, and Jericho has like a little moment of weakness, and that's when Slade takes over and is like, get out of my house, which I thought, like, him saying, get out of my house, and if you ever put the Titans back for a weekend, I'm going to kill you all, is what he said 5 years ago. I'm like, either shit or get off the pot, Slade. Like, do something and back it up. But I think that he probably is threatening that because Jericho was like, don't kill them. I just want them to suffer. And then it also makes me think that, because I think May brought up the whole thing that maybe Jericho is Rose, which I didn't think that was necessarily the case. But I do think it might be the case now that she has been in on it from the beginning. Like, she doesn't hate her father. And that she got herself captured by Dick on purpose. And they have all, like, the whole entire Slade Wilson, or the whole entire Wilson family has been doing this coordinated attack on the Titans since the beginning of the show, is what I think.
I like that prediction, and I'm going to second it.
I'll third it.
Yay! Lady of Gumption of the Week nominations?
We have what? There is no ladies on The Flash, so can't really see that one. Black Lightning. I don't really give... I mean, Lynn saved a life, but she was also on drugs. Or being made...
Anissa, I would say Anissa for the, you know, Harriet Tubman Underground Railroading of Metas.
Okay. And then Titans.
Blackfire.
Yeah, that's, you know, true. For
her sister made fun of her hair at a wedding in front of everybody. She was like, fuck that shit. I'm killing
fuck
your
that. I'm
your
burning court. Down the whole
I'm
thing.
Killing our parents, taking over the planet, making
and
you
your boyfriend.
Exactly.
And she still loves her sister. Like, because at first, last day, she's like, you know, we could be, you still love your sister, right? We could be co-queens.
Yeah. So, nope. You love Blackfire.
It's like, you murdered mom and dad. I don't want to rule with you.
But okay. I love, yeah, it was just so funny when she was like, she killed all these people, she did all these things. She's like, well, you haven't been great either. You made fun of her hair at the wedding. Yes.
And I think after that, like, after that comment, like, Corey got, like, unnecessarily petty, like, about the race. Yeah. And, like, let me shorten it for her. She couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so... As a whole, who did we have? For Supergirl, we had, was it Kara?
Kara for investigative journaling.
Mary for Batwoman. Mm-hmm. And Thea for Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Did we have another person? And Zoe. Thea and Zoe for Arrow. Zoe. And then Anissa and Blackfire.
Yep. I would vote Kara for side A. And... Blackfire for side B. I support Blackfire's claim to the throne.
May?
For side A, I would probably go with... I want to say Kara, but I want to also say Mary, too.
Yeah.
because she had to take care of a guy who almost killed her and did it anyway and got some information out of him.
I support Mary's claim as well.
I throw side B out the window, to be honest.
Okay. So Mary, let's give it to Mary.
Yeah, I think we can give it to Mary.
I love it. Well, thank you all for listening. All hail Queen Mary. You can catch us next week. Same bat time. Maybe. We're not actually very good on time. But same bat place for sure. And you can contact us at ladieswgumption@gmail.com, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, or DCTVGumption on Twitter. Thank you, and good morning, night, or afternoon.